work, you can go to my website, ralphwhite.net.
Yes, and I'll be getting a website sooner or later.
We'll get one sooner rather than later. And remember, we are on the air on the second Wednesday month at 10 p.m., bringing you the Open Center Show.
Thank you so much.
So thanks to Araceli, thanks to Sharon, thanks to Michael,
and
thanks to
Sydney,
our engineer, and wishing you a good night.
And you're tuned to WBAI in New York and WBAI.org. The preceding program, the Open Center program, the Open Center Show, the Open Center over WBAI. And please call 1-212-209-2950. Our next scheduled program will be an Earthwatch Hour of the Wolf combined effort. If you're a comic book fan, this is the crossover edition. So please stay tuned to WBAI. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck, the Public Enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
Bonsoir, moi c'est Jeton, n'attendez radio WBAI 99.5 FM, et puis c'est là, c'est WBAI.org. Bon radio, bon radio, bon radio.
Hi, this is Spike Lee, and you are listening to WBAI, Community Radio in New York City. WBAI exists almost entirely on your support. Please be generous. Thank you very much.
And you are tuned to WBAI in New York. I have to say one thing. I had meant to broach it during the previous program. WBAI has a very long history of dealing with the spiritual. Lex Hickson, many years ago, as you know, as some of you remember, longtime listeners, Lex Hickson followed the Sufi path. And one day at our previous location, we were in Midtown. We had two floors. I happened to be up on a balcony that overlooked Midtown. Remember our wonderful balcony? Anyway, so Lex was on the air. It was a Saturday, and he said, "We're going to use the Empire State Building as the world's tallest minaret." He had an imam on, and the imam gave the call to prayer, and I happened to look over at the Empire State Building with the monitor on, and it was the call to prayer. It was, in fact, at that time, the world's tallest minaret. So, you're tuned to WBAI in New York, and I hand you now over to our heroes, Robert Knight and Jim Freund.
Well, thank you, Sidney Smith, regular fellow.
Depending on what was well. Okay, so, let's see, are we both up here? I can't quite tell.
Not yet.
No, there you go.
Not yet. Now, we are here. This is what's called an interstitial, folks. Thank you, Sidney, for your engineering. Thank you,
Tony Ryan. What, we're between the veins and the arteries?
This is...
That's what interests the show anyway.
The Wolf of the Earth.
Okay.
It does look
this is
like
sort of like when the orchestra is tuning up. We have a great show for you this morning. And it is a long-awaited collaboration, confrontation, and revelation between Earthwatch and Hour of the Wolf in regard to Mars and issues of Earth. Welcome, Jen.
Good morning, Robert. Thank you. It's lovely to be here. And when you say long-awaited, I think we once did an Earthwatch together.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was at 62nd Street.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm not sure.
359
so, you know, Sydney was talking about a long time ago, and I'm talking about a longer
Well,
time ago.
Let me just give a hint before we get into it, formal and proper. We are going to be discussing the latest movie from the oeuvre of Edgar Rice Burroughs. It is called John Carter. That is his slave name because they're not admitting that he's from Mars at the moment, but they probably will in the sequels. And we've had some vibrant conversations about that, and we're going to engage in those tonight. But this being an educational institution as well, we have a couple of wonderful things. One, because we are going to address and assess whether there are subliminal, you know, colonialisms and racialisms and such in the film, and whether they're extant or transcended or whatever the case may be, we are also offering one of the most insightful documentaries on this very subject for those grounded on Earth who are not yet prepared for Mars.
Yeah, let us just say that in the original Edgar Rice Burroughs, there was nothing subliminal. It was overt.
Visceral, was it?
Oh, yeah, it was visceral. Mm. It really was.
Well, I am so proud to be doing this with you tonight, Jim, because it is something that some people will think we are pretending to teach. But I'm happy because I'm going to learn from your
great
knowledge.
Well, that will be a mutual learning. Yeah. I mean, it was a wonderful thing. Let me, by the way, just mention that one of the things we're going to be doing somewhere before 3 a.m., because I tweeted this, and I know a lot of people will be tuning in just to hear a reading by Catherine M. Valenti, one of the best people writing science fiction fantasy today, mostly fantasy. And she has a story set in Barsoom that is extremely relevant to our topic and to, well, an incentive to pledge it we'll discuss later. But what is underlying it all was that March 9th, 2012, was the 100th anniversary of the publication of A Princess of Mars. And I had some premiums of a book called Under the Moons of Mars, which is not an Edgar Rice Burroughs book. It is a book of contemporary writers.
Yeah.
And it was time to come out both with the 100th anniversary publication, with the movie that was opening, John Carter, which was opening the same day, and the postage stamps, by the way, the John Carter postage stamps that are coming out next month.
Get out. I didn't know about that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is, well, it's, you know, for some, a big enough deal. So I wanted, Robert has often been kind enough to loan me his airtime, especially during fundraising drives.
And,
So that we could do do a 3-hour special. This is the first time we're combining forces, which you wanted to do for a long time. And I suggested that we combine forces because I know that as a younger person, Robert had read some Edgar Rice Burroughs. He's certainly fluent in science fiction and fantasy. And I'm just trying to give a précis here. I said, let's do this show together, and together we can promote this book, mm-hmm. and we can also promote the movie, and we can talk about Edgar Rice Burroughs. And a question came up. Edgar Rice Burroughs, this is a gentleman who, in his writing, had been known to use the phrase mud people. This is a gentleman who, and I said, well, yeah, it was, that's more Tarzan than John Carter, but certainly John Carter is about imperialism, a lot of it based on race, a lot of it that, you know, those who are from here simply by, you know, genetic whatever are superior to those. And Robert said, as a reader and science fiction person, that sounds good, but I am also a journalist and a person with responsibility where I have to be thoughtful about what it is that I am promoting, especially to a certain number of younger people who have not been exposed to this. Yeah. It was a fascinating conversation where we both had different sides. It was, in the proper use of the word, an argument about what's race and our modern definitions of it. And when Kathy Davis, our public affairs director, although she's, you know, our everything.
Hardest working woman in radio business.
She's our department head of everything here. And, yeah, hardest working woman radio, no question. And cool, also. Forgot to mention cool. And she and I also had this conversation, and she said that, well, that really opens up an idea about a concept, this DVD, called Race, The Power of an Illusion. And these two different topics dovetail perfectly.
And what we are going to be offering you tonight is a revisioning of some of the bases and concepts that are behind the movie from Disney called currently called John Carter. And
it should have been John Carter of Mars, but they changed it.
Yeah, even I know that. Yeah. You know, it's a stupid thing. They did some superficial demographics and studies, and they thought that people didn't like movies with the word Mars in it.
Because that's for boys.
Not that people know all of the good movies about Mars have been made, like The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yeah, that's right. Is he a Martian?
Yeah. Well, come on.
Is he specific? He's an alien.
A windy, sandy place that's red, and he needs water.
Fair enough. I thought it was Dune or Arrakis or something. Mm. Yeah.
No highliners.
But the original title, of course, was The Princess of Mars, and Disney became allergic to the word princess.
Yes.
Because they put out a really good animated film called The Princess and the Frog. That didn't do well because boys thought, oh, the word princess in Disney.
And the cruise line.
And the cruise line, no doubt. But it was just, you know, princesses in Disney mean boys won't go to it. Yeah. And then they dropped the Mars because girls won't go to that. So what did they do? They came out with a movie that, thanks to their marketing, nobody went to.
That an audience that was neither here nor certainly not there. And so, but listen,
we'll get to that
but before
later.
We get to that.
Yeah.
We are also honoring our charter commitment as an educational institution, including the arts, which is a form of entertainment and one of the mandates of our broadcasts ever since 1949 in the Pacifica Foundation. And we have for you, for a pledge of $100, the three-hour-long, one of the most astute studies, audiovisual studies of the very concept of race in these United States and around the world. And we are also offering the compilation book, the new volume that, as you will see later in our conversation, takes us beyond the circumstances and quirks of Edgar Rice Burroughs. It is called Moons Over Mars. That's available for a pledge of $35.
This is Under the Moons.
I'm sorry. There's a shorthand on my notes here. Under the Moons of Mars and New Adventures on Barsoom, which is the name that Burroughs gave to his fictional
planet.
Well,
Under the Moons
Mars.
Of Mars was actually a title Burroughs used mm-hmm. for certain things.
Mm-hmm. So all of that is available, but we want to spend the first little bit of time so that those of you who have a curiosity, who are frustrated about the way we're, like number six, always imprisoned by the concept of race, which slams like a gate in the face of our hopes of togetherness, mm-hmm. we want you to call us up at 212-209-2950 in order to have really satisfying excursion into these issues. But more than that, to have something that you can share with children in your family, in your neighborhood. You might get this DVD and share it with your local school, the way that things are going nowadays. But the number is 212-209-2950. And if you could, I'm hoping for two or three dozen people to get the teaching audio visual DVD called Race, The Power of an Illusion. You would not believe how many calls I get about people who, you know, say, well, you know, race isn't really a valid concept of anything. So 212-209-2950 is the number. And we're going to pause for a few minutes and let you hear about 6-7 minutes of the quality of the exposition of this. It is produced by a fabulous team in a public television group based in California, but universal in their presentation. It's produced by California Newsreel. It's a three-part documentary series whose parts are The Differences Between Us, The Story We Tell, and The House We Live In. And this is a great disabusement of many things that even I, and possibly some of the rest of us, might have misperceived about this concept that we use so easily, the term race, racism, and so on. So on behalf of me and Jim and Enlightenment and Togetherness and Pacifica Principles, here are a few moments of that while you are calling 212-209-2950 for a gift incentive for $100. And if you pledge $125, you get them both. You get the specific and the general. You get the power race, the power of illusion, and Under the Moons of Mars. 212-209-2950. Let's make this work, and let's make us smarter and better. Here we go.
There is no question that individual human beings are different, one from the other. Our eyes confirm this day in and day out. Skin color, body shape, hair form, eye shape. For several hundred years, we have used these visual differences to classify people into four or five groups we call races.
We have a notion of race as being divisions among people that are deep, that are essential, that are somehow biological or even genetic, and that are unchanging, that these are clear-cut, distinct categories of people.
And the beauty of the race business is that you can identify people by just looking at them. You don't even have to look at their genes, because one manifestation of their genes is there, namely skin color or eye shape or hair shape, and then that's the key to everything.
The idea of race assumes that simple external differences, rooted in biology, are linked to other, more complex internal differences, like athletic ability, musical aptitude, intelligence. This belief is based on the idea that race is biologically real.
All of our genetics now is telling us that that's not the case. We can't find any genetic markers that are in everybody of a particular race and in nobody of some other race. We can't find any genetic markers that define race.
And actually, what we're going to generate are billions of copies of a little section of your genetic code. And we're going to look
These
at
students are gathering for a DNA workshop led by Cold Spring Harbor Labs teacher Scott Bronson.
Pipette up 30 microliters, fill it to
Marcus, Gorgeous, Jackie, Noah, Hannah, Jamil, and their fellow students are about to explore the biology of human variation.
But there's another type of DNA. Does anybody know what that type of DNA is? Yeah.
Mitochondrial
DNA. Very good.
They will compare their skin colors.
They're like not human colors.
They will type their blood. And they will swab cells from inside their mouths to extract a small portion of their own DNA. Once the sample is ready, they will compare some of their genetic similarities and differences.
We're going to look at a very tiny section of this ring.
The students begin the workshop with the same assumptions most of us have.
As you begin to look at the data, you might want to keep in your mind who you think you might be most similar to and who you think you might be most different to.
I think I probably have the most similarities with Mr. Bronson or with Carol because we were white males, both Carol and I and both Scott Bronson and I.
I think I'd have the most differences with Carol and the most similarities with Gorgeous.
She's African-American, I'm African-American. I mean, like, black.
I think maybe me and Natalia are most alike.
She's Latin American and I'm Latin American. I figured that there would be tons of differences, especially with people who looked so different.
Person type two.
To understand why the idea of race is a biological myth requires a major paradigm shift. An absolute paradigm shift, a shift in perspective. And for me, it's like seeing, you know, what it must have been like to understand that the world isn't flat. And perhaps I can invite you to a mountaintop and you can look out the window and at the horizon and see, oh, what I thought was flat, I can see a curve in now. That the world is much more complicated. In fact, that race is not based on biology. But race is rather an idea that we ascribe to biology.
The idea of race as biology is ferociously persistent on America's playing fields. Gorgeous Harper and her teammates are competing at the Adidas Nationals.
I love to run track. I've been running track since I was 8 years old. The people I train with, they all want to be the best, and you got to put in the hard work.
This is the top event for elite high school track and field stars. And while racial differences are not necessarily discussed openly, they are often part of the careful calculation of competitive edge.
I've heard some rumors I've heard are just like blacks have an extra muscle in their leg, but I don't think anything's true.
I assume that a white girl can't beat me in the 200. In my mind, I don't think she can beat me, but I won't sleep on her.
I don't want to get too controversial here since I really don't know exactly, but I'd say that there's maybe a little bit that, not to use as an excuse is why they beat me sometimes, but maybe considering when you look at the Olympics, you know, who tends to dominate the 100, the 200, and the quarter for the most part. I just have to say the way it all falls out tends to point to what your race is.
But I'm really saying that different populations, whether it's West African descended blacks, and that's what African Americans trace their ancestry to West Africa, or East Africans, or whites or Asians, they all have different body types and different physiological structures that allow them to have advantages in one sport or another. There are as a genetic basis for these kinds of differences. Through culture, environment, training, athletes can't dramatically change the limits of what they can be.
I would like to say to John, there is no scientific definition that holds up about race. Race has changed its definition in this country to the benefit of those who wanted to define it differently. And there is no scientific place to start from, so you have no basis for your work.
We can see differences among populations, but can populations be bundled into what we call races? how many races would there be? 5? 55? Who decides? And how different would they really be from one another?
The measured amount of genetic variation in the human population is extremely small. And that's something that people need to wrap themselves around, that genetically we really aren't very different.
In fact, genetically, we are among the most similar of all species. Only one out of every 1,000 nucleotides that make up our genetic code is different, one individual from another.
There you have our first sample of one of the most important documentaries on social anthropology that you will ever have. We're offering that to you for a pledge of $100. But we want you to get that plus Under the Moons of Mars, about the relevance of the illusion of race on this planet Earth and its connection perhaps to fictions on planets abroad. This is WBAI. It's Pacifica Radio in New York. And we are during our fund drive right now, which is the only way that we can maintain a continuous, useful string of thought without constant interruptions. If you ever try to watch TV news, you'll know that is because you directly support the station. And we're offering Race, the Power of Illusion, a very highly produced and tremendously smart documentary on the very subject Jim Freund of Hour of the Wolf and I, Robert Knight of Earthwatch, are discussing tonight. So the book is $35. The DVD, which is a three-hour exegesis of this issue, is $100. But you can get them both for a pledge of $125. And in making that pledge, you're also supporting the concept of dangerous intellect, the concept of exploration of sensitive issues whose going through may help improve our relations and cooperative and constructive abilities. Now, we've given you a sample, got some more standing by, but right now we need you to actually do the deed and go to your phone and call us up. We've got a little computer thing. We can see when and how many people are calling. 212-209-2950. Please give us a vote for idea of being humans together and of there being a space like Wednesday night, which I think the Wednesday block is the smartest day of the week on
WBAI. It's the geek block here on WBAI.
Okay, who's going to be the first one? We need, we've got a dozen lines open. We've got a nice group of people, listeners like you in the back, ready to answer your calls. Can we take a moment now for you to join us and say you want to explore these things? 212-209-2950. We have to pause until we get some results here.
That's the deal. I mean, we have a lot to talk about, Robert and I. We have about three or four agendas, which are really, really alone could take up the 3 hours. But we're also leveraging that. We are using that in order to encourage you to call and to support the station. And this is a circular kind of thinking. We want you to support the station so that this kind of conversation can happen, and we will make that conversation happen when you support the station. So you need to call now. 212-209-2950. For a $100 pledge, we will give you a copy of this fabulous documentary, Race, the Power of an Illusion. And by the way, let me say, CCH Pounder as narrator. Yes. And also, for $35, this remarkable, fun book of modern stories based on Barsoom by Edgar Rice Burroughs. But this is a modern book edited by John Joseph Adams with a who's who of fantasy literature in there for $35. But here's the deal. Get both. Get both for $125 bundled together. And you will really be supporting the concept of an Earthwatch / Hour of the Wolf.
An Earth Wolf.
An Earth Wolf mix that we can bring you, that you will howl over, that you will enjoy, and that are frankly unique in radio.
Okay.
I don't know anything.
I'm going to call in a bit. you know, there are people I know who call my show, and many intelligent people who call yours. And I know
both
there
of
are
them,
people
yeah.
in Brooklyn. I know there are people in Staten Island. And every week we talk about what keeps us apart. Well, we're on a high diving board tonight, and we're counting on your support for the concept of bold explorations cross-culturally into mutual interests. So,
and cross-programming as well, so in order to show that common interest as well.
What is not important is our talking, but what is important is your talking. And I'm sitting here looking at the screen, waiting for a dozen of you to join us at 212-209-2950 at the $3,500 or $125 pledge level. We want to leave a footprint on the dust of the Martian radio tonight. 212-209-2950.
And that footprint should say on it, I saw that DVD. 212-209-2950.
It's called Race, the Power of an Illusion, and it challenges one of our most fundamental, some people's most fundamental beliefs, that humans come divided into distinct biological groups. Well, how could they breed if that were the case? The definitive three-part series is an eye-opening tale of how that's in here, of how we of what we assume to be normal, common sense, even scientific, is actually shaped by our history, social institutions, and cultural beliefs. 212-209-2950. Need to see the tally moving so we can talk and share more. Can't wait to get to Burroughs and Mars and all of that.
And this topic of race. I mean, because the way it's amazing. I mean, these two things were sort of coming together. And I think I have to credit Kathy with when I told her about the John Carter thing, with her saying, oh, you need this book, Race. Mm-hmm. This DVD Race. She saw immediately what the connection is. And let me tell you that you will, too. The moment that you start partaking of this, you will see how they work together, and you will see how WBAI works with your mind in order to expand it in so many ways, in both forms of entertainment and in didactic forms.
All right. We're halfway through the first hour here, and I wanted to complete this part of it before the top of the hour. So now, I'm asking people who were with us during our coverage of the Trayvon Martin case, people who were with us throughout the wonderful history of Pacifica and specifically WBAI during civil rights, to be able to refute the bigotries, biases, and incomplete learnings that you confront each day that keep us apart. I know there are people who care about that, but we need you to care about it right now. Who will be the one to inspire the others? 212-209-2950.
We need you to be a sponsor.
It's tax deductible. We need you. Yeah.
We need you to be a sponsor. That's what it comes down to. The concept of listener sponsorship, not just listener support, like you get in these other worthy institutions where they use the donations to say, yes, I'm a listener, and then they go to other people and
Well, we're the inverse of NPR. They're about 80-90% grant and corporate funded. We're about
90%.
We're about listener funded. We got a couple of CPB,
Corporation
for Public Broadcasting grants, but we need you right now. I'm feeling lonely, but I know you're there, and
we can
please help us take care of Caesar's world so we can go into a higher realm. 212-209-2950. Who will support us? The book is something that really takes us into another world, a world that is perhaps kinder than we might have imagined. We want to take this thing apart, but it means nothing without you. Somebody give us a call, just even to prove the phones are working.
Yeah, let's start with that. Let's start with the very premise that you simply want to make a donation, that you know that the very fact that this show or combination of shows is happening during a fund drive, because let's face it, you could be hearing a tape. Instead of hearing a tape, you've got two live producers who have not produced together as much as we want to with this opportunity, and this opportunity is here because of the fundraising drive. Make that happen. Make that pay. Tell the programming departments and the powers that be at WBAI that you want more of this. Show the phones are working. Right. Robert was just testing it to find out. 212-209-2950.
I know there are people there who love,
right
and
now.
Who love what we try to do here. 212-209-2950.
That was one of them right there.
Yeah.
212-209-2950. We're getting to the point where we just simply need to recite the phone number until you get the idea that it is up to you to pick up that phone
perhaps
and make that donation now.
At 212-209-2950. Perhaps people are still stunned by the idea that race is a fiction. Maybe we should share another little sample?
I think so. I will say before you put that on, two things. Number one, I find the premise challenging. I did not think of it that way, but upon reading the brief and following this, it's like, wow, that is something else. So it truly is educational. Number two, speaking of educational, I remember very clearly when I was in grade school, I was told, I don't remember the number of races that existed. There were five. I think there was Mongoloid was a race, right? Caucasoid. There were all these oids.
Negroid.
To which all I could say was oid ve. And it's not, and we now know that it's null and void, having nothing to do with Gary. It's just void. And we are learning this. It's now the next century. It's now the 21st century. And people haven't learned yet, but we are holding the discussion. We are holding the premise. And a lot of that premise is in this documentary entitled Race, the Power of an Illusion.
About which the Philadelphia Inquirer calls it one of the most honest and compelling documentaries I've ever seen on race and the impact of it on this nation. And Pat Williams, the sister attorney from The Nation, says, a marvelously intelligent documentary, a timely reminder that social distinctions are made and not inevitable. It is a three-hour set that is on DVD with added-on features. Episode one, The Difference Between Us. Everyone can tell a Norwegian from a Nubian, so why doesn't it make sense to sort people into biological races? Examine the contemporary science, including genetics, that challenges the assumptions about human groups.
Episode two, The Story We Tell. Hasn't race always been with us? Explore the roots of the race concept, including the 19th century science that justified it and how it gained such a hold over our minds.
And the house we live in. Race may be a biological myth, but racism gives different groups vastly different chances in life. Even after the civil rights movement, the playing field is still not level, and colorblind policies only perpetuate inequity. 212-209-2950. Ladies and gentlemen, we're serious. Are you? Give us a call. 212-209-2950. You're supporting science and ethics. You're supporting your DVD option for $100. You're supporting the book Under the Moons of Mars for $35.
Which is speculative fiction, which is also intended to make you think about the different ways people are apart or together or use the excuse of color. And boy, on Mars, are there a lot of colors in order to keep people apart, together, warlike. Mm-hmm. It's all about the social significance, while at the same time it is provocative and entertaining. 212-209-2950 is the phone number to call to pledge your support to the radio station in New York that explores these questions.
It's a dangerous journey that we're on tonight, Jim.
It really is. It really is.
It is perhaps not comfortable for people to think about, but everybody who's ever encountered any aspect of it must learn how to refute the application of it. That's why we're offering you this. Here's a sample of it. Please make those calls because we will be divided and distressed if you do not call during this little sample of a very profound liberation of the mind and society. This is from Race, the Power of an Illusion. We're offering you that tonight. 212-209-2950.
Genetic variation in the human population is extremely small. And that's something that people need to wrap themselves around, that genetically we really aren't very different.
In fact, genetically, we are among the most similar of all species. Only one out of every 1,000 nucleotides that make up our genetic code is different, one individual from another. These look-alike penguins have twice the amount of genetic difference, one from the other, than humans. And these fruit flies? 10 times more difference. Any two fruit flies may be as different genetically from each other as a human is from a chimpanzee. So the central question for us is, of the small amount of variation between us, what, if any, is mapped along what we think of as racial lines? Because we live in a racialized society, this is not an academic question. We have a long history of searching for racial differences and attributing performance and behavior to them. For 200 years, scientists poked and prodded, measured and mapped the human body, searching for a biological basis to race. Some measured facial angle to illustrate the proximity of races to the primitive. Others calibrated skull size to identify those with superior or inferior intelligence. Measures of eye shape, hair form, even brain color were scrutinized in the hunt for the fundamental sources of racial difference.
If we just take African Americans as an example, there's not a single body part that hasn't been subjected to this kind of analysis. You'll find articles in the medical literature about the Negro ear and the Negro nose and the Negro leg and the Negro heart and the Negro eye and the Negro foot, and it's every single body part. And they're constantly looking for some organ that might be so fundamentally different in size and character that you can say this is something specific to the Negro versus whites and other groups. Scientists are part of their social context. Their ideas about what race is are not simply scientific ones, are not simply driven by the data that they are working with. That is also informed by the societies in which they live.
At the turn of the 20th century, American society was riding a wave of confidence as an emerging industrial power. And the face of its power and prosperity was white. African Americans lived under the yoke of Jim Crow segregation. Most surviving Native Americans had been banished to reservations. And new immigrants crowded into urban ghettos. Disease was rampant. Death rates soared. Infant mortality was high. To many, this reflected a preordained natural order.
Those that looked wanted to confirm what they saw, which is to say that the proper place of, say, the Negro, or in other regions of the country, the Native American, or the Chinese, were at the bottom of the social and political hierarchy. And if you can say that they are fundamentally biologically different, then they should be. Then it's natural for them to be at the bottom of our social hierarchy.
The biology becomes an excuse for social differences. The social differences become naturalized in biology. It's not that our institutions cause differences in infant mortality. It's that there really are biological differences between the races.
For Prudential Life Insurance statistician Frederick Hoffman, those differences could lead to only one fate for African Americans. In Vital Capacity, he wrote, "The tendency of the Negro race has been downward. This tendency must lead to a still greater mortality, and in the end, cause the extinction of the race." Hoffman's Race Traits and Tendencies of the American Negro was published in 1896, the same year the Supreme Court legalized segregation. It was one of the most influential publications of its day.
What's interesting is that it resonated in the minds of so many other social observers of the time, the extinction thesis. It fit into their notions of how races become ascendant in the world. They looked at other groups of people in various stages beneath them as approaching the completely civilized stage.
Hoffman presented his statistical data as unimpeachable science. He compared rates of death and disease between African Americans and whites, and, not surprisingly, found enormous disparities. But his data analysis was flawed. He ignored the insidious effects of poverty and social neglect on health. In contrast to today's belief in black physical superiority, Hoffman concluded that African Americans were innately infirm. As such, attempts to improve their housing, health, and education would be futile. Their extinction was inevitable, encoded in their blood. By the 1920s, a single drop of blood reflecting African ancestry could identify any individual as black and inferior in every way. In the not-so-distant past, many of these students would have been considered contaminants were they to have bred into the superior white race. 28 states passed laws forbidding intermarriage to safeguard white racial purity. Racial purification was one aim of the eugenics movement. The science of eugenics rested on simple Mendelian genetics. One gene each from father and mother, it was believed, gave rise to any trait, physical, behavioral, even moral.
Some of these things were things like the ability to play chess, rowdiness, congenital feeble-mindedness, virtually any cultural or behavioral trait you can imagine. Now, the mistake that they were making was assuming that complex behaviors could be reduced to simple Mendelian genes.
Nonetheless, eugenicists used the science of the day to advance a social agenda widely accepted in white America: to breed the best and the brightest, always white, and breed out society's worst and weakest of all colors.
This is Earth Wolf. This is
Wolf Watch.
The Wolf of the Earth.
There. Oh, best. I like that.
My name is Robert Knight, and that's Jim Freund over there. And this program is usually called Earth Watch, and his The Hour of the Wolf. And I've got to say that this is a challenge and a triumph, because we are engaging in one of the most real discussions in this planet, in this nation today, that of the artificial construct called race, oddly applied to people who can interbreed with each other no matter where you are on this planet.
Yeah.
And we see the fruits of racism. As a matter of fact, let me tell you why we are so on time, just like you're about to be when you start calling 212-209-2900. There will be this 2950. Sorry about that. 212-209-2950, and make a pledge to support WBAI and get the fabulous documentary called Race, The Power of an Illusion, 3 hours of refutation produced by California Newsreel in partnership with us, that we're offering you for a pledge of $100. That is a tax-deductible pledge, and we do that so that you can have a foothold in the future of WBAI and its existence. And for $35, we have the book that we'll be discussing along with John Carter of Mars, the book Under the Moons of Mars, and that's available for a pledge of $35, both for $125. And I've got to say that I want to say two things. One is that this Saturday there will be, on this very subject in Foley Square at Lafayette Street and Center, a Tale of Two Cities, a march and rally to end the race-based New York City stop and frisks and arrests and other biased New York Police Department policies, part of the campaign to end the new Jim Crow. Michelle Alexander was on a show that I used to work for as a correspondent just the other day, to great accolades on, well, of the Colbert Report. I actually worked for The Daily Show. And they come in tandem. And if what we have done for more than half a century here at WBAI can be celebrated elsewhere, we need you to support the people who brought the discussion forward. That's what we're doing tonight. So we can't hardly wait no more for you to start calling 212-209-2950.
And that's the bottom line right now. Robert and I both have agendas we want to talk about. I mean, you should hear what we're doing off the air with this whole thing. And this whole conversation, the whole premise for our show began off the air, and we want to bring that on the air. But the fact of the matter is that before we can bring that on the air, we have to be aware of the fact that the first hour that we're embarking on this, the first Earthwatch hour between midnight and one, is a prime time. Robert is looking at the computer where we can see the online listeners and saying the numbers are going up. Well, they're going up, but what hasn't been going up yet is the tally. We need the phone calls to pledge now. 212-209-2950.
I think we're scaring people by talking about something so visceral, so raw in American history at this moment, and in the politics and wars of the world. I did not want to do this, but I respect Jim Freund so much as one of the most intelligent, articulate, and ethical people around here. And as he has intimated, as we hope to discuss unencumbered by the need for finance from you, he approached this with ethics, and I with concern, and here we are, and we need you to vote for that kind of confrontational courage, of conceptual courage. 212-209-2950.
It's the kind of thinking that goes together at WBAI that doesn't go together in too many darn places in this world. Mm-hmm. And it is because that we are from so many different communities joined into in one community. That one community is a community called WBAI, part of Pacifica Radio, that came up with the idea to begin with, that the person behind the microphone, the person who you are listening to, is the person who's actually thinking of the things to say. That's how it all started. No scripts. Well, even if it was scripted, because initially it was scripted, it was the person behind the microphone who you heard talking to,
herself or himself, wrote, written it.
Who exactly had self-written it. So it was the first time that people were allowed to say what they were thinking and not mouth what somebody else was thinking. That came to fruition in the late 40s. And now it is no longer just the pilot experiment that Lou Hill and friends started it out to be. Now it is an important institution, but it is an institution fighting the continual, constant battle of funding, because we have made it hard for ourselves by saying in order to be pure, we need listener dollars. We need everybody, their sponsor tells them what to do. If your show is sponsored by the Vanilla Ice Cream Corporation, your show ain't going to say too much bad about vanilla ice cream. What we need to do in order to be able to open our minds and open our mouths and our hearts is to have the sponsors we want. We choose our sponsors. Unfortunately, that's you. Or fortunately, that's you. So it's time for you. No. Don't turn around. It's you. You're the one who for a moment at this vision of a phone in your head who said, yeah, I don't care, I'm in Brooklyn or Staten Island and everybody around me is a red stater, but I believe in what they're saying on WBAI. I need you right now to pick up that phone and dial area code 212-209-2950 and make a pledge for WBAI.
And I know there are people there who have done, could be, will, gonna do it. Last week, the listeners were very generous to us here, and likewise with you, Jim. And we believe that there's more than those who called before. And you really are a part of the inspiration and the attempted resolution. And now we need you to be part of the solution. Can just a half dozen to a dozen of you make a call right now to reassure us that we are, that the eyes of our listener sponsors are upon us when we go upon dangerous missions like examining race, culture, art, and the separations of society and justice, therefore. You know, we've, you know, had great success. You know, when we talk to people like Michelle Alexander and when we apprise you of the events like this Saturday's noon rally against the racially biased, illegal, and costly marijuana arrest crusade and stop and frisk policies of Mayor Bloomberg and the police department. So we are a way that you can liberate yourself on the street, but educate yourself right now. 212-209-2950, please.
And at the same time that you educate yourself, we also try to entertain you. The two can go together, and the two often do go together. There was an era in WBAI, a long era, in which there was a belief that if you were being entertained, if you were doing arts, if you were doing music or something, you were not taking care of business, you were not putting bread on the table. But that kind of thinking has fallen by the wayside. We are back at a time. The struggle hasn't gone away, but we're back at a time when the belief is that entertainment is good. It opens the mind. It opens the heart. And there is no reason why good entertainment isn't provocative and evocative of thinking about new things. This is the power of science fiction. This is to be able to look at alternate worlds. But we're also talking with this documentary called Race about the fiction of science, which, as time goes on, progresses. Yeah. Well, it's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's what it is. I mean, as I said earlier, I remember being told that there were an exact number of races.
All right. Listen, there are people here with kids who need to know how to not get caught in the traps of the separation that is designed into our housing system so that people of one culture and ethnography do not hook up with another unless they're buying or selling drugs with each other. We are here to try and have the schools be more minimal to equity and equality. 212-209-2950. There are people with children who need to be able to refute the pejoratives that will be hurled at them. And I know there are such people listening, because if we were giving, Jim, the on-air line number, there would be a flood, a switchboard of calls.
Every phone would be lit.
Now, if you love the block of Earthwatch and Hour of the Wolf, we need you to say so, so that we can say so, so that the station can say so in ways that have nothing to do with us. We have a duty to support the collectiveness of WBAI, and even though it's us speaking on the microphone, it is a resonant circuit, and it does not amplify the power of people of goodwill until you demonstrate that you're willing to make this station exist with a pledge of whatever amount of financial support to WBAI at 212-209-2950. If you like Jim, then call 212-209-2950.
If you like Robert Knight, call 212 instead.
212-209-2950.
Exactly. So I hope that you have those two numbers firmly in your head. If you're voting for Robert Knight, 212-209-2950, but instead if you want to vote for me, 212-209-2950. Have you made that separation? Good. Now, Make that call now. Make that vote now. 212-209-2950, by the way, if you're undecided. That's the other category.
Yes, yes,
yeah, undecided.
2950.
We'll accept phone calls from the undecided as well. 212-209-2950. It is paramount that the station continue to survive. It is an important thing that it remains the kind of station that will allow freeform journalism entertainment to all mesh together to bring you a mix, the kind of which you find nowhere else, not even necessarily on other listener-sponsored radio stations. WBAI is a unique experience, and it has a unique sound. The concept of free-form radio, as practiced by Robert Knight, as by Robert Fast, by any
noble
number
tradition
of Roberts, is really, you know, it is it has been picked up, actually, at another New York area radio station.
Really?
FMU.
Oh, yeah, they're great. Yeah, no, good
yeah,
station.
FMU does that. But they took it from us. And I think they're quite, frankly,
NPR is an extension of what
journalism
originally, yes, existed at Pacifica.
As produced journalism.
Yeah.
But right now, in this block, and that's absolutely true, what Robert said. I mean, ATC, All Things Considered, / Morning Edition, was largely started, heralded by people like Neil Conan and Margot Adler and people who came out of Pacifica Radio.
Yeah.
And that's it. And even at one time, CBS News had basically its head writer was
Bob Krolwich.
No, Paul Fisher.
Krolwich, yes,
did his own show. And who was it who went to NBC? Who was it? Oh, was it Bruce Soloway? Somebody from WBAI did what I thought was one of the best overnight news shows on television, called simply NBC Overnight. It was with Linda Ellerbe, and I think it was Bruce Soloway. The things from different people that BAI brought into the larger world are fascinating and worth it.
Jim, I took a call offline here, and this is a listener. And what did you tell me a moment ago?
I told you that it's the only radio station that we can get regular updates, and I like them more regularly, but at least we get some regular updates on the Fukushima situation, grave as it is, with several attempts now in front of Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN, to address Reactor 4 building and the containment of the spent fuel rods, which sit 100 feet above the reactor vessel, which has been destroyed.
Humpty Dumpty.
And this is extremely important, and at least
and
BAI gives us information on this kind of happening.
Would you, good sir, please take your insight about what we do here at WBAI and advocate for your co-listeners to call?
Well, I do constantly, and I wish they would, and remember that it's a listener-sponsored station. That means it survives by the people who contribute.
All right, folks, you heard that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And hopefully the people that contribute are the people that
listen. Okay, come on now.
212-209-2950. When you take a look at the major media out there, the major media, they've just come out with a movie about, okay, what do we have? We have Fukushima, must be on everybody's minds, should be on everybody's minds. What does the mass media come out with? There's a new movie about Chernobyl. I mean,
this just in.
Yeah. Exactly. It would be a great title.
All right. During this song, let's get a dozen calls. 212-209-2950. Thank you for the astute listener. Come on now. Let's hear the first one. 212-209-2950. You got to make it real. The word has to be made financial. It has to be made flesh. It's up to you whether we can Continue to have intellectual courage on your radio station. 212-209-2950. Group dial now. 1-212-209-2950.
I want everybody who actually has a dial on their phone. How many people have dials on their phone?
Click. Pulse coding.
Calling. Or even touchtone dials. They had those for a while. Everybody, I want you to pledge double. But everybody else can just do $100 in order to get Race the Power of an Illusion or the moons Under the Moons of Mars, edited by John Joseph Adams, a who's who of fantasy writing on Barsoom for $35, or both for $125. And the bonanza of that is you are then really supporting WBAI at 212-209-2950.
Now, the audience of WBAI has always been among the forefront of civil rights and human rights and equity and respect. And what you get on the DVD, Race, the Power of an Illusion, is a complete unedited version of 3 hours of material of the most brilliant scientists and sociologists from California newsreel, taken from across the country. Scene selection menus and episode details that is a really professionally done package. The first part is The Difference Between Us, that tell us that the superficial differences are just because of geographic and climatic adaptations, and that the genotypes, the DNA, the RNA are different only by one part in a really big number. And we're trying to reinforce humanity so that we have a basis from this earth to talk about the issues we'll confront with extraterrestrial concepts and contacts. And we really do want to go into how war and race and economics factor into this. This is a kind of discussion you do not generally get on other channels that purport to represent science, society, and
fiction. And
we want
to get to that discussion itself, which we haven't really done. We've been teasing you.
We're not going to have it unless we get some damn calls.
And that's what it comes down to. Yeah. Gang, 212-209-2950. We're not going to do one of those, oh, this thon is pulling teeth or anything like that. This is ransom. This is in order to have the show happen that we've been planning for. We also always knew that this was going to be a fund drive show because we know it's worth it.
Our audience keeps going up, but we need the calls. 212-209-2950. This is only the second week of the marathon, and y'all were really, really good last week, and you were very supportive. I wish we had time to talk about the brilliant event. You were there, Jim, with Dr. Michio Kaku.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. If you missed that event, you missed...
Beautiful audience.
Great
house.
More than that, aside from the fact of all the spiffies that Michio was talking to, which for a lot of science fiction people may be old hat, but for most people out there, they were eating it up. I got to tell you, the energy in that place, the turnout of WBAI and other listeners, the turnout of people that were there to listen to a theoretical nuclear physicist talk about things that will be there in the future, the possibilities of what they are, and tied in together with the possibility of this radio station that can do it. And the fact that Michio, by the way, has not forgotten his roots. I mean, he's become a big effing deal between Discovery Channel and BBC America. I cannot turn on
New York Magazine
TV
thinks he's one of the smartest people.
And so does he. You cannot turn on the TV set on cable channels mostly without seeing this guy. But it began, his media part of it began with a show called Explorations, and he has not given that up. And why hasn't he given that up? Because he
loves
us. His roots.
And you need to show us some love with a call to 212-209-2950. You're tuned to WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. And we know that you can handle the truth. In fact, we're counting on you to help distribute the truth. to your youngers, your elders, to people who may have remnant misperceptions about things. 212-2 In fact, I'm among them. I have misperceptions about things. I do not
I don't think
understand biology
sufficiently.
Doesn't.
I mean, that's what it means to be alive until you're always learning. You're
so
always.
Call us and get this. Race the power of an illusion. Come on now. We need a dozen or so of you. But
you know, one illusion that we have to not accept as an illusion, and one thing that is raw fact, is that this radio station needs to survive, and in order to do that, we need your call. 212-209-2950.
Here are some of the episodes in this wonderful thing called Race the Power of an Illusion from California Newsreel. Virginia and the slave history, African slavery in this continent, the assimilation of Indians or of the native populations. I refuse to call them American Indians, you know, that's kind of ex post facto nominalism.
The autochthonous people.
The civilization of Cherokees. Indian removal, parts 1 and 2. Science enters the debate. The 19th century so-called science of race. Ladies and gentlemen, we need to know what not to do anymore. Get it for yourself. Get it to share. Have a party with it. Remarkable transformation. By the time slavery ends, there is a potential fertility, but it gets transmuted into the policies we see today at the NYPD. Where there, you know, it turns out, there have been more young black and Latino people arrested than there are living in New York City. The New York Police Department is just sort of like the slave catchers that are the beginning of a federal police force in the United States. And they've arrested more young black and Latino men than live here. That means they're going after every colored face that moves. How can you, you know, and people will revert to, well, you know, most crime is done by the niggers. But you've got to understand the statistics and the falsity and the history. And that's why we're offering you Race, the Power of an Illusion. And that's just from one of the three different segments. What makes race, if there is such a thing, European immigrants, ineligible aliens? This thing is deep, y'all. Racial logic, I think that's an oxymoronic wink and a nod there. Blacks move in, white flight, dual housing market. This is something that is about how we are made schizophrenic among each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is something that divides people from people in so many ways. And race is so often considered the dividing line. There was a time when, oh God, all the Italians and Irish are moving in. Oh my God, we got to stop the Jews from moving in. And, well, we brought the blacks in. Can't do anything about that other than keep them down. And stuff like that. So,
well, it certainly improved the quality of my food and choices.
Well, yeah.
Diet.
I mean, this is my favorite thing. But yeah. And why I think New York is so great. Because you get all those flavors. Mm-hmm. And you can do that on a regular basis. But that's not race. That's culture.
Mm, true.
And now, I celebrate culture.
Speaking of culture, one of the things we've not done tonight is appeal to your fears. And we have instead tried to dress you as people of sophistication, even if of incomplete education, myself included, that we're appealing to the best of you. Using a difficult subject as a springboard to a cultural discussion of great vitality. So if anybody respects the respect for your intelligence that people at WBAI present to you, it really is incumbent on you to call and pledge your support at whatever level you can, 212-209-2950.
I mean, that's the other side that Robert was talking about, because the old thing that, you know, I don't even want to go near because it is such it is such an old canard that Bill Murray on a National Lampoon album made fun of us like by doing a "What have you done us in?" and we weren't here, man. And it was, but that's the side that Robert was talking about, appealing. Aside from appealing to the fears in terms of race and this and that and the other thing, let's appeal to the fear of what if we're not there? I mean, here we are it's easy to say these are difficult questions. I mean, the idea of me coming on the air and talking about race is something that just frankly gives me the heebie-jeebies, because I am not good at political argument, and I have to change my mind about things all the time, because hopefully I am learning all the time. New things come along, and that's a lot about what this DVD is about, by the way, is teaching new concepts, new things, and unlearning what we have been taught. Well, all that aside, the educational side, the what if, that's the one side of the fear. The other side of the fear is, if we're not doing it, where is somebody doing it? Where can you call up and talk to Robert Knight about these issues? Where are they covering the aftermath of the nuclear disaster in Japan? Nuclear disasters, by the way, which began in science fiction before nuclear disasters began, to the point where at least one science fiction writer was, had published a novel called Nerves, this is Lester Del Rey, was taken out during World War II by a number of agents and asked, "Where did you get this information?" and kind of thing. And Lester was a regular radio person. He was frequently on WBAI's airwaves. He also used to be on, by the way, a lot with Long John Neville. Yeah. And without a WBAI, without an Earthwatch, without an Unnameable, without an Hour of the Wolf, without a Night Shift, without these things, where are these things being discussed?
212-209-2950. If you are of the high concept of an ethical, intelligent radio station that seeks to bridge the gap between cultures and eliminate the invidious and insecure falsities of race and racism, then is this something that is above and beyond the call of duty of normal people? Or can we be an army of consciousness? Can we be an enzyme of integration, of peace and understanding? And I thought that's what we were about here. I know there are there's a tremendous number of people listening, and we just need several of you to demonstrate that it is of value to you when we bring things that can help you and help you help others. And I really, really am beseeching that you call 212-209-2950, because once a noble concept will not be here if we ever disappear.
That is true. And we are not here even this particular morning in order to preach. We're here to talk to each other and to talk to you about ideas that we have and have shared as like-minded people about community radio, but people who come from very different experience, even though we share a lot of the likes for the same flavors of things and similar concepts of justice and spiffiness and entertainment and all that, and to put those together, but coming from these different places in order to explore these concepts can be so much fun and so interesting. And that is what we came here to do this morning. But we came here to do that knowing that if we put it up the flagpole, you would salute. Well, it's time to salute. Salute now. 212-209-2950.
All right, seriously, there is a woman in Bensonhurst. There is a brother in Brooklyn. There is a cosmopolitan somewhere in Fort Lee. There are people in Westchester, Connecticut, and elsewhere who deal with these issues every day and want to be able to succinctly and informedly address them, teach them, and help others with it. I want each of those people or someone like them to give us a call now to 212-209-2950 so that we have the fragrance of contemporaneous life that is measurably supporting WBAI. You know, yeah, goodwill is nice, and goodwill is part of what we depend on for our continuity. But really, folks, it makes a difference to the people here who are trying to be a catalyst to you and others like you that we see that happen now. NOW 212-209-2950. And we're coming to a transitional point. And
we need to get to that transitional point. We need to have gotten to that transitional point by having made a dent in the tally and telling everybody involved at the station, this worked. This worked. This is a good idea. We know
that. No, Jim, I think
idea.
They're scaredy cats.
You do you?
Yeah.
Yeah. What is it exactly because, that they're scaredy of?
Well, you know, some people say race is the number one problem in America. It's not an easy subject. It's, you know, it's like trying to say, here's how to avoid murder. Maybe it is something that people think that they're beyond. Maybe it's something people want to deny and sublimate their attitudes of inferiority or superiority or of invidious comparison of superficial differences among people. Maybe it's a hard subject for people to
well,
address.
It is. It is. I mean, I think it's not the pervasive thing. I think you used the other four-letter word earlier that is the pervasive thing, and that thing is simply fear. Mm. I think it's all about fear, and race is the area in which people express their fear of the other.
If there's any group that thinks this subject is applicable or useful or important only to other groups, then you know you're a racist.
There you go. Or a theorist.
Well,
How about that?
A theorist. Come on, folks. Let's have some transformative commitments here. 212-209-2950. We have fewer than 10 minutes left for the nominal part of Earthwatch, but we're going to continue with our discussion about Mars and Barsoom and Edgar Rice Burroughs and the premiums are under the moons of Mars and Race, the Power of an Illusion, DVD 100, the book for 35, both for a buck and a quarter.
And this whole thing began because this movie, John Carter, was coming out, because we got this book, Under the Moons of Mars, that, by the way, was donated to us, I should mention, by Simon and Schuster, 20 copies of this, and we didn't buy these and resell them. These were donated outright to us, and we want to thank them for that, and we want you to join them in those thanks by taking advantage of this. But the whole reason that this all began was because we were talking about a subject that began 100 years ago, March 9th, 1912, with the publication of the book form of John Carter of Mars, A Princess of Mars, it was called. And because of the era in which it was written, there is all riddled with racism here and there, which certainly would not have been perceived by the author or by most of the people who were reading it at the time. But now here we are, 100 years later.
Michio talks about the fish in a shallow pool who think there are only two dimensions in the place in which they live.
Yeah, and this goes back, you know, going back to the science fiction, you know the book I'm thinking of. Yeah. Michio would be the first one to name it, Flatland. Edwin Abbott's classic book, Flatland. Oh. Two-dimensional creatures that are trying to imagine the concept of a third dimension. And this is where a lot of the thinking beyond what is in front of you begins with. And that is one of the things that speculative thinking and speculative literature can do for you. And this is why Robert and I are joining forces this morning, is to talk about that. But we cannot do that if we don't let the platform upon which this is occurring, listener-sponsored radio, to occur. And in 8 minutes, within 8 minutes, we need to see, before that transition happens, we need to see that you are recognizing the value of that kind of thinking, that kind of talk, and what it is that we have to offer. So if you're interested in this book, Under the Moons of Mars, edited by John Joseph Adams, a $35 pledge will get you a copy. If you are further interested in this brilliant three-part DVD documentary, Race, the Power of an Illusion, $100 will get you our thanks, our gifting to you in return for that $100, that DVD. And for $125, that's a This Evening Only special, we will give you both. And you will be thanking us for being there, and we will be thanking you for supporting us. It's a two-way street, but we need to do that before that transition occurs in 7 minutes.
212-209-2950. If you recognize this composition, give us a call and thank us for knowing what you know. 212-209-2950, so that we can have a bed of lettuce before we get into the salad dressing. 212-209-2950.
And it might be a Caesar salad, which itself could
be sees her, sees him, I don't know.
Exactly.
212-209-2950.
Food jokes, sorry. But you never used to be able to walk into the planetarium without hearing this.
Sure. This is Dr. Holst. 212-209-2950, and it is, we think, appropriately about Mars. Mars, the bringer of war.
Yes.
Well, let us now have these moments to contemplate Mars, the bringer of pledges. 212-209-2950. Do we have to, talk about that Disney movie before you give us more support than you have?
Yeah, I mean, talking about the falsities of money there, where they say that movie lost $200 million and they fired the head of the studio, where in fact, everybody liked that movie. Mm-hmm. When you got down to it, it got very good reviews.
Jim, I'm going to trust the listeners and so that we can do a little bit of choreography in here before we engage in the Martian discussion.
Okay.
And I relinquish to you the con, but I'll be on the other side of the microphone field.
Okay.
And you can re-welcome the listeners, and we'll get, into the discussion about that guy, that movie,
okay, but
that book,
but
that
in
concept.
Order to do that, please, everybody note that he said he's trusting you. Okay, and so am I, that you're going to pick up that phone. You heard the number. Yeah. Now make the call, 212-209-2950. that onus is still upon you. 212-209-2950. Good morning. This is Watch of the Wolf, or Earth of the Watch, or all of the above, or some of the above. I am Jim Freund. With me is Robert Knight, and we are here this morning not only to raise money for WBAI, which is an ongoing struggle that you will be doing, right? You are calling 212-209-2950, but also we are here to discuss some difficult concepts of what do you do when some of your most beloved literature has taken on overtones or perhaps undertones. We're going to use John Carter and Barsoom as an example. Stay tuned. And again, good morning. I actually have mixed feelings about playing my theme because this is intended to be the ultimate crossover show between Earthwatch and Hour of the Wolf. So, you know, individual themes are sort of beside the point. But we needed a breather there, and it seemed like an appropriate way to breathe. But we're going to remind you of the onus upon us all to keep the radio station funded by reciting the phone number, but we're also going to get into the topic which brought us together for crossover to begin with. And let me just say, Robert, thank you, because this has been a hellacious week for you between your hostly duties at that wonderful benefit on Monday, which, by the way, I've got to say, I worked the front door at that benefit, something I haven't done in a long time. And boy, it felt good. The energy.
We felt the love. And,
it was great.
We were trepidatious, but the house was huge. The crowd was enthusiastic. They laughed at the jokes. They got the science. The
receiving line even after the reading, because
it went on forever.
That was as long as the presentation was, about 90 minutes of people, and nobody was wasting anybody's time with Michio.
It was a good feeling of people being together in the flesh, in the form, and
it was a WBAI event. It was totally a WBAI event. Mm-hmm. Without us, it could not have happened the way it did. Mm-hmm. And it was just so much bleeping fun.
Yeah.
And such an energetic, positive, good feeling to be there. Mm-hmm. And it made money for us.
Yeah.
And here's an important thing. Let me tell this to the staff. Mm-hmm. Of WBAI, as well as to the listeners for WBAI. The more we learn how to raise money off the air, the less we have to do in reciting a single phone number while on the air. Mm. This is an important thing.
People voted with their bodies and minds and their presence. For those just joining us, I know you have a very knowledgeable audience, but there may be some new people. And this is WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5. And streaming with great numbers tonight at stream.wbai.org. And
the numbers are
worth,
up, by the way. Yeah,
it's worth mentioning the Pacific Emission 91. Statement, which is why we are able to have uninterrupted periods of pure thought, unlike the commercial broadcasters that surround us. And the Pacific Emission Statement says a few important things. Just want to refer to one or two or three of them. And perhaps your understanding of that will sublimate my inappropriate expectations of your generosity at this point. And that is, one of the commitments of Pacifica is to establish and operate for educational purposes in such manner that the facilities shall be as nearly self-sustaining as possible. To also provide outlets for the creative skills and energies of the community, Jim, like so much of the talent in science fiction and art and sound you bring us, to conduct classes and workshops in the writing and producing of drama, etc. And here is what we think we are doing on this day. And this is so essential to the cultural ethos and our attempt to scientifically refute the concept of race and racism. In radio broadcasting operations, to engage in any activity that shall contribute to a lasting understanding between nations and between the individuals of all nations, races, creeds, and colors, to gather and disseminate information on the causes of conflict between any and all and such groups, and through any and all means compatible with the purposes of this corporation, to promote the study of political and economic problems and of the causes of religious, philosophical, and racial antagonisms. This is WBAI, and I hope that before this program is over, you might find a pragmatic way to support the concept with a call to 212-209-2950.
And one of the most important things that WBAI has always done since it joined Pacifica Radio in 1960 is it has found a way to work toward that mission and fulfill that mission statement, expressing itself not only politically, not only didactically with lectures, but with the arts, with things that
the people must.
Yeah. To open your mind for different ways of thinking. I mean, the thing that I love to tell most often is when I started volunteering here, God help me, what's today's date now?
What century is this?
Last century, but the point is that when I began volunteering, it was May 1st, 1967. So that's 45 years and what?
That's only 4 months into the existence of this as a Pacifica station.
No.
A year. And,
7 years.
Okay.
We became a Pacifica station on January 10th, 1960.
I thought it was the 9th.
Around early January 1960. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's the 10th. Okay. I think it's the 10th. Could be. Splitting hairs there. Yeah. But it was, I believe, the first thon. Although Robbie Barish says otherwise. Yes. He says it was the second thon.
Well, we are here tonight to try and bring a Pacifican context to the huge movie called John Carter, Bracket of Mars, Bracket.
Yeah, but one of the things I wanted to say just before that was when I came here to WBAI to volunteer, the things that I was hearing that brought me in, one of the first people I met when I walked in the door was Samuel R. Delaney, Chip Delaney, one of the great science fiction writers of all time, one of the first acknowledged Dahlgren. Black science fiction writers, Dahlgren probably being the masterwork. And he was producing a radio drama for BAI, a two-hour drama called The Star Pit, which remains this day. The sound may be a little bit crude. The thinking is still fresh. It's still dynamic. And it explores so much. In that case, he had a concept in there. Do you remember the story?
Dahlgren, gosh.
No,
I don't know that one.
There is a concept of these people, the golden, and people who think that they are the golden. It is not a race per se, but it is an attribute and something that allows people to travel beyond. And when you start thinking about the subtexts in that brilliant, brilliant novella, it starts showing how the power of fiction, and specifically science fiction, and specifically speculative fiction, can open up new ways of thinking. But this was not always the case.
Yeah.
100 years ago, a writer who I don't know his personal political leanings exactly. I think his main leanings were, I want these books to sell. Edgar Rice Burroughs basically invented space opera. And he did it with a book called A Princess of Mars. And was the first book in a, it had been published earlier, in magazines under several titles, including Under the Moons of Mars, but it was never codified until that book came out March 9th, 1912, 100 years and a month ago. So, 2 months ago. And this movie came out to celebrate that or to take advantage of it.
Wherein hangs the tale.
Yeah, exactly. And I come to the station. I come to Robert, to either share airtime or donate it, and to Kathy Davis to make it a part of the thon. And say, we have this premium of new stories set in Barsoom, and this movie is opening. Even if we didn't have the premium, I'd want to be talking about John Carter and that movie. And a question came up.
Well, how can I support this is the question that came up for me.
Yeah. And I said, because this is a guy who, is at the very least supporting imperialism, and at the very worst is doing it on the basis of race.
Well, no discussion of Edgar Rice Burroughs can be complete without several caveats. Of course, for many people, the most prominent is that he is the author of the Tarzan series, in addition to a science fiction series. And there is, for me, a troublesome conceit about the Tarzan series, about a pure, whiter-than-white British nobleman going into the exotic jungle of the colored people and the primates. And being just naturally and intrinsically superior and becoming the worship object of that because he is a white British nobleman.
Never mind that he's a feral child. Never mind that he's basically being raised by chimps or whatever.
Which is interesting about environment versus heredity.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the point is that he's blue blood, Lord Greystoke. Mm-hmm. And as blue blood, he is able to hold hold sway over the savages, which have no culture.
Which is inseparable analytically from the colonial period of the turn of the of that century, of the Asiatic adventures of the British Empire, and from Gunga Din to the Pacific, you know, the whole thing. And I don't even want to overdwell on the cultural arrogance that is misconstrued as race in regard to Africa and Tarzan and all of that. But if
but we had a cultural problem here in bringing the show to the air.
Well, never mind that. We're here now.
No, we are, but because this is what was grown from that. The point being that all I wanted to do was revel in the geekery and the fun of this thing without thinking of the consequence of the content.
Well, we'll get, if I may.
Please.
If I may. You are more knowledgeable than I, and this I readily and with admiration admit. But if I may just offer the first gambit here.
Yeah.
Edgar Rice Burroughs was born, I think, around 1875. And as soon as he was old enough, he was born in Chicago. And as soon as he was old enough, he was in the U.S. Army campaign out west in Arizona shortly after. And while it was still very much a painful and vibrant part of the American ethos of the destruction of the Apache nations. And he writes a book that begins with the adventures of such a noble Confederate white man.
Confederate, let's underscore that word.
Who he describes as being just... Oh, well, Massa, we just loves y'all so much that he was celebrated and loved by the blacks who were the slaves under, you know, his time. And because so we go from that to him out there cleaning up the Indian territories and...
Actually scavenging.
Well, actually...
After having
cleaned. Actually being a colonial outtaker of mineral wealth.
Yes, yes,
he's there
yes.
digging Indian gold.
That's what I just said. Yeah, that's exactly correct.
And,
or we
and in the transition of what Edgar Rice Burroughs originally wrote, the movie was rewritten to say that he wasn't doing that. And that the killing of the Indians was, you know, accidents will happen.
Well, I mean, what happens in the
movie... So they laundered the movie.
The of course it's laundered. It has to be laundered. Yeah. A, it's Disney, okay? Disney launders. This is, I mean, Disney even, they launder Cinderella, the original Oshpuddle. They launder Peter Pan.
Fantasia. Well, actually, Fantasia began with its own segregation.
It had
yes,
the bleach
with,
built in.
With no chromatic miscegenation.
There, no. You're incorrect. That was simply cut out. There were black. Yes.
No, I'm not talking about blacks. I'm talking about blues with blues, reds with reds.
Oh well, there's that. There were little black centaurs and stuff that were cut out of the film.
But they were not integrating the way one might do in a free social setting.
God, no. Yeah. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Cinema could not go that far. Entertainment could not go that far. And that was certainly true in Burroughs. But what Michael Chabon, and this is an important name. Because
he is one of the rewriters of the screenplay, right?
He is the screenplay. He wrote the screenplay.
Uh-huh.
He and Andrew Stanton, the director, wrote the movie. That's it. Michael Chabon is not an average writer. He's a Pulitzer Prize
Spider-Man?
Winning. Say what?
Did you work on Spider-Man?
No.
No, somebody else. I'm thinking
Oh, wait. Yeah. Maybe he worked on the movie. Yeah, did he? He might have stooped that low. It is possible. But he's considered a literary writer. He is not a science fiction writer. What he is he's a writer of great literature that stoops down. Now, he would never think this. But the literary community, the stodgy community that views science fiction as a ghetto of literature, which it always was when we began and is still not really accepted. There are still those people who say, well, you know, science fiction can't be good. And you say, well, you know, what about, the argument was always, what about 1984, Brave New World, these things? And they would say, well, that's not science fiction. That's really great literature. The two are mutually exclusive in people's minds. Science fiction came out of the pulps. And what Edgar Rice Burroughs was writing was pulp fiction.
He was well, I'll give him more than that even. And as a person who studied engineering and physics and such, one can, at the same time as criticizing the social construct, acknowledge that Burroughs was someone who did attempt to learn science and converse with people. Percival Lowell was busy at the time, and there was much speculation about Mars. So he took his, in my estimation, he took his psyche from this planet and superimposed it on the planet Mars. And there were some things that he got very much right. And one of them was the concept of this white Virginian nobleman going to Mars and becoming intrinsically, much as Tarzan did in the jungle, a superior being of whiteitude who could leap tall mountains in a single bound, which was actually scientifically correct in that the gravity of Mars, which is about one-tenth of the mass of Earth, is about two-fifths of what it would be on this planet Earth.
And so his, the conceit is that his muscles
he could jump.
That are built for Earth and therefore have a different effect there. But then that doesn't explain why if you drop something, it doesn't, you know, drops at the same rate as it would drop on Earth. So his physics only went so far.
F equals MA.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And
it was where convenient, there it was. But I perceive exactly what you're saying about the comparing Tarzan and John Carter. Now, they are both the great white hope.
Now, here we are in the second decade of the 19th century. The second decade of the 20th century when this comes out.
When it's published.
1912-ish or thereabouts.
Yeah.
And
written a little earlier.
So here just imagine my amusement or consternation about a white man who finds a MacGuffin, a device that transforms him, much like Avatar, to a different planet, in this case, the planet Mars. Now, what does he do? He meets people who are, in my estimation, thinly disguised surrogates of the Indian people who are being annihilated at the time this is coming out.
They are
in the years before.
They are Native Americans.
You've got green creatures of seeming cruelty and indifference and non-family values that he hooks up with. I forget the name of them. Then there are the others that are the four-armed white gorillas. And to me, these were mindful of the indigenous nations of this continent and of the slaves of this nation and reconstruction period and the sort of like sneering kind of contempt about the viciousness of their innate qualities. And so yet he goes to these groups and he hooks up with the ones who in the movie, and this kind of peeved me, or had me peeved, that the most sexy Hollywood humanoid types were, I think, the Red Martians. And here they look like Romans. And they dress like tarts, the women. And
well, in the book, they're naked.
Well,
so dressing them like tarts is a step up.
So I'm seeing not so much a concept of interspecies or interplanetary curiosity. You see, I see this differently from the way that Nicholas Roeg looked at a converse of David Bowie coming to Earth, rather than a white supreme warrior being the superior to all of the native cultures elsewhere.
Yeah, by the way, I'd like to credit Walter Tevis, who wrote the book.
Well, my bad. I meant to mention that. Or something like the writings of a woman of South African nationality, Doris Lessing, who you...
Oh, God, I love Doris Lessing.
You turned me on to her. And I loved everything from Briefing for a Descent...
And Margot on Our Wolf. Margot turned her on to me.
Briefing for a Descent into Hell, and the space fiction series, Canopus and Argos. Mm-hmm. There was also interplanetary seeding, but not on the militaristic violence killing level. It was more like a psychic monitor with a long distance means of communicating and observing.
More, yeah.
So you have the macho, you have the perception of women as toy objects. Now, you know, some of them may have had some level of accomplishment, but it's still, you know, pulp fiction. And so he uses all of this conceit and, like any superior being, on a planet with old cultures and multiple languages and stuff, different language, all of a sudden he masters that like nothing. So I see it as a colonial supremacy adventure that is modeled on the British and American adventures in Asia,
you know,
and on the genocide of the Indians, and on the enslavement of Africans and the continuing diminution thereof.
Now, you know what's funny about what you say is that it's true, but my perception is that some of that colonialism that you are referring to, okay, I don't think was so much taken from Burroughs. I think some of that was added into the movie.
Really?
I think, yes, yeah, yes, yeah. And I'll tell you
explain
why.
Explain that.
Because... The Mark Strong character, the invisible character who pops in and out and comes and has the ability to pop to Earth and back and all that, who is the one that actually incites John Carter going to Mars to begin with, is not in the book at all. If he is, he comes much, much later. And in the book, it's more the Tarzan thing. It's more simply the fact that the white man goes there and he is superior, and that's it. So it's not colonialism. It's merely the superiority of Lord Greystoke kind
okay.
of thing.
So the
but by inserting that Mark Strong character, somebody says the line in the movie, which I may not have noticed if you and I hadn't had this discussion at the time, when I finally saw the bleeping film, and John Carter or somebody says, if we don't stop these people or this race or this guy, this can happen to Earth. Bang. And therein lies the excuse for colonialism, the excuse for fear of the other, the excuse of why we have to defend ourselves against the other.
And there is the rationale of what the Obama administration is doing now, as the Bush administration did before, with these optional wars that violate United Nations charters and protocols of war in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Pakistan. And that is, I will grant and accept that may not have been Burroughs' initial intention.
No, but let's talk here about Andrew Stanton and Michael J. Bond, the movie that they made. Mm-hmm. I mean, because this here is very legitimate. This here, this is a perception that I had that they did to in order to get away from the racism that was inherent in the era of the book when it was written. The fact that the book has racist undertones because it's the society in which it was written, not that Burroughs himself was looking to denigrate anybody.
From the frying pan of race to the fire of war.
Bingo. Mm. Bingo. That's it. So we have moved from one problem into another. Not, and again, I think it's a subcultural unaware thing. I don't think that the people involved in making this movie are saying, how can we justify the current actions going on in our society?
Put them in a hurt locker.
Exactly. How can we do that? No, that's not what they were thinking. I believe that the people making that movie are as blind to the political import of what was going on there as Burroughs was blind to the racist import of what he was writing 100 years ago.
Wow.
Science fiction is always about today. It is always about the year in which it is written. It is 1984 is about 1948. Yes. That's one of my favorite little sayings. Yeah. And it is always about the era in which it comes out. So, A Princess of Mars and the Edgar Rice Burroughs stuff that I say, yes, I know, it was racist, it was this and it was that. It was just so much fun when I was a kid and blah, 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 and all that. And how can we get over it? Can we listen to songs that have, this is my pro, I was playing one of my favorite songs, Shaking the Blues Away. I love this song ever since I saw Ann Miller tap dance to it, and the lyrics are fine, there's nothing wrong, do what the voodoo do and all that. So I'm on the air in here and I find a wonderful old version of that song, which I hadn't heard before. I put it on, and what are the lyrics? It ain't what do the voodoo do, it's do what the darkie do. And I'm going, oh my goodness, oh my God. I had to stop a song on the bleeping air and playing it on the air. I am so embarrassed. And I love this song. I love this song. And here it is. The undertone. What does one do with, you know, Max Schmid playing Moon Over Africa, these Jungle Jim, all of these things of that era that, well, I'm not going to say Jungle Jim is good or Moon Over Africa. They have no virtue. But some of the songs, Mississippi Mud, all of these at the time, they were good stuff. They were not intending to denigrate anybody. It was the society in which they existed. Which was problematic. Dare we stir those waters and show them to people now and say, this was something good. How do we handle that? That's my question.
This is a Socratic dialogue. I'm learning as we talk. One of the things that I think also...
And by the way, I have no answers here. I'm bitching. I'm moaning.
One of the things that is also going on here, if I understand correctly, and I have an inferior knowledge of the literature of Burroughs, is that one of the conceits of the film was retrofitted ex post facto from a subsequent novel to The Princess of Mars. That is the one about the shape-shifting manipulators.
Yeah, that's the Mark Strong character I was talking about. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that gives me kind of spooky shivers. Because there is yet another form of speculative cultural imperialism that at one point in the debate decades earlier we called von Däniken-ism, the chariots of the gods, that the little smart things in the remnants of ancient inferior cultures could only be there because a superior race came and gave it to them.
Well, in the case of von
chariots
Däniken,
of the gods.
And what's the proof? It's in the Bible.
There
was Margot had von Däniken on Hour of the Wolf, and I engineered. It was quite an experience to be there, and I helped connect her with this wonderful pulp editor and writer by the name of Hans-Stefan Santesson, who I think was in his 80s at the time, and actually lived not that far from the church where BAI was located. So he was a regular guest on Hour of the Wolf in those days. And he knew his science fiction, and he knew his aliens, and he knew his Bible. And he was able to take von Däniken straight on with those things. But yes, that's exactly the idea, that the images in South America that of along the cornfields could only have been created by some superior race, because it could only be seen from a height, and the simple peoples of that land, of course, could have little sophistication.
And in a way, the reversion to the idea of a similar superiority, of a superiority that is similar to oneself, using the other, the colored, the Indian, the African, the Asian, as a foil, may actually be, in addition to its use of racist and cultural cliches, it may be an expression of inferiority, of the writer trying to reflect one's self in these superior creatures who are the meta-coordinators of cultural conflict, of the United States policy in South Asia, of maintaining enmity among nations, among cultures, which is exactly the opposite of Pacifica's goal, of instigating chaos in Libya, in Syria, of the master, of the trans-master, the supra-master race. And in order for an author to conceive of her or himself that way, racism is almost not as much a goal as a consequence of asserting that superiority.
Well, that's exactly my point. That's exactly where I'm coming from, is because I do not see it as their goal, I am...
Of course I'm not a racist!
I'm less offended by the individual writer in many of those cases, because it is not their goal to make anybody inferior or even necessarily superior, yes, because the Superman story is that which will save us all. And that has all this cultural stuff. Danny Fingeroth, who I had on this program a few months ago, great editor and writer at Marvel Comics, put out a book on why Superman had to be Jewish and had to be created by Jews, because that's a whole show, and I hope that people listened to it. And he has books on the topic as well.
Siegel and Schuster, were they Jewish?
Duh. Most of the original superheroes, with supernatural powers that were able to
sort of like a good Ubermensch.
Well, yeah, one for our guys.
Yeah,
you know, because look at the forces against us. Kind of thing. And at an era when Jews were not being allowed into the U.S. unless they were able to support a particular purpose, a particular goal. And they were the nowhere people of that decade.
Everybody needs heroes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you don't have to construct them by making others zeros.
Right. And this is what society did. And I am more willing to forgive certain science fiction writers, or writers, period. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to cut them a little slack, or at least say, you know what, I'll try to enjoy your stuff and ignore that, because I understand when you listen to old records, you can't always get rid of the static. And you know what I'm saying? And some of this racial stuff,
the static, the high frequency hiss. You mean the white noise?
that was a bit pink. But I take then another exception to those writers who were racist because they were nasty mofos. H.P. Lovecraft, for example. I mean, who apparently I'm told by some people. Would atone or try to see, you know, he pulled a George Wallace. He tried to.
I think he's a great comedian.
I like that one. Yeah. tried to.
The black one.
Chubbier one. Mm-hmm. Tried to change his. His outlook like a couple of years before he died, probably through what you were talking about earlier. Fear. But in stories like, I think it's The Horror at Red Hook. Red Hook is in the title. And yes, that's Red Hook, Brooklyn, where Lovecraft lived for a while. Actually lived in Brooklyn Heights in anything with those kinds of things.
Very nice.
Lovecraft wrote horror, this visceral, amazing horror, because he didn't like people and he wanted to scare the bleep out of them. He was just he was a nasty piece of work. And the racism that one finds in a similar era as Edgar Rice Burroughs is not there because of the undertone. He's the overtone. He is overt. That's a different story altogether. And yet there is pleasure to be gotten out of Lovecraft, as can be seen by the popularity of The Cabin in the Woods, a movie I will not see.
Now, Jim, here's something that perplexes me. Perhaps you, or the audience, or anybody else can, send a note or help me out with this. I only had one, rapid viewing of
John Carter. Right.
But when I analyzed it structurally, the interplanetary conceit was similar to that of Avatar.
Yes.
And just as a moment ago I said, you can have heroes, but don't make others zeros. One of the other conceits about this supreme man of Virginia, his manners were perfect and courtliness was that of a typical Southern gentleman of the highest type. So, characters like this, whether it be John Carter, whether it be from any ethnic self-aggrandizing literature involving alien cultures, these usually male protagonists go elsewhere and they just dazzle them with their superiority, whatever that distant culture is.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. They are an output device. They are a write-only device. There are a much smaller percentage of them learning except just to adapt in order
That's
to
right,
do what they do.
Yeah.
And so even though in both Avatar and in Princess of Mars, which became the John Carter movie, mostly, There is a male kind of phallocentric, aggressive kind of imposition.
You're saying male, yes, but young male.
Testosterone. And
almost pre-testosterone. I think it's like 12 years
what
old.
What I think is different about Avatar is because even though there were invidious military imperatives behind the program, I stipulate that right away. But our bird's eye view, our character, our protagonist, was involved in a program to, in the same way as a virtual transportation to the distant planet, as in Mars, as in Avatar, to observe, study, learn ecosystem, cultures, habits, organization of society. I think there is more of that receptive thing in Avatar than in John Carter of Mars. And so this is why I hark back to Doris Lessing, why I would call Avatar a slightly more sensitive film. Because the anthropological rather than the military was I think more salient.
I think that you're right, but I think the reason for that is that Avatar was written in modern times and John Carter is still subject to its source material. And so it wasn't able.
So it had to be retrofitted.
It had to be retrofitted.
Or is it
exactly.
Post-fitted?
And thank God they didn't do the book. Because the book really sucks. It's fun to read, by the way, and people can go to gutenberg.org in order to read it. It's all public domain. There are 11 books in the series, and there's a very, very, very good video on the history of John Carter on YouTube that was actually made for my reading series. Initially, that was in fact part of the intro to something that we're going to have to put on in a little while. If we're going to get it on at all, the subject is too fascinating. I just wish people had pledged enough that we could have started this part of it at 12:15.
Well, you know what, Jim? Maybe it was our turn to give tonight.
Well, maybe so, but I also feel that we give
at the office
at the
we give and we get it.
on an ongoing basis. You're doing it, you know, in you know, 4 days a week plus one, as it were. You know, the giving never stops, but it's also time for people to support that giving. It's also time for people to cause. One person has donated $25. Thank you. Let's do a little more. By the way, for $35, $10 more than that $25, you can get a copy of Under the Moons of Mars, which is edited by John Joseph Adams, New Adventures in Barsoom. Yeah. These are not necessarily John Carter stories.
No, these are a bunch of new people of great vision and brilliance, is this?
Yeah. Oh, yes, but it's also not necessarily about John Carter. It's Barsoom. It takes place on Barsoom. Ah. John Carter may or may not be a character. In fact, he is not a character or has anything to do with over half the stories.
So it's bringing a wider clarity of the issues that one will eventually confront, no matter where one is, about xenophilia.
Yeah, and exactly. And among the writers that we have here are Theodora Goss, wrote Woola Song. Dora Goss, she is one of the great writers of modern fairy tale and myth, as is Catherine and Valenti, who we're going to hear in just a couple of minutes. Sure. Genevieve Valentine, who came here live on WBAI to read her story, A Game of Mars, from this book. By the way, there are wonderful illustrations throughout this book by wonderful people. Garth Nix, Chris Claremont, Chris, of course, the writer of X-Men for like 25 years and a regular on this program. He's going to be here in July. Jonathan Mayberry, he actually wrote a very typical John Carter kind of story. Great Jedi. Joe Lansdale, David Barker.
Speaking of X-Men, I've got to mention, there's another analog of this concept of psychic traveling to a more primitive circumstance, and that is the comic book. You reminded me when you mentioned X-Men. Remember Kong Gorilla?
No, I can't. I'm pleased to say that
the great gold, not the great white hope, but the great golden ape. Once again, the color was not like the other ones.
Yeah. Philip K. Dick had a story about a golden man that was very interesting. Mm-hmm. The Golden Man.
Sounds savage.
He was. He was like the ultimate military creation. It's a fascinating story, a very good story.
Jim, I know you have some material to play. I don't want to
expand
into the time for that.
But by mentioning
I just wanted
this
to thank
book,
you for this discussion.
Well, and likewise. But let me just say that this discussion largely came out of John Joseph Adams visiting New York. He used to be on the show regularly, but now he's in on the left coast, and came to New York and at the time that this book came out, and got 20 something copies of this book donated to WBAI.
Bravo.
And you can get a copy of this book if you donate $35, a mere $35. The book alone, I believe, is, if you were to buy it, it'd be about $20. So by giving a $35 donation to WBAI, you'll get this book for free. Mm-hmm. And you will be supporting this radio station, and we will be saying thank you by giving you a copy of this book, which is, by the way, the point is, a modern view that is based on this most imperfect view of what can be done.
And, you know, if we had a T-shirt for this, it would probably say, I went to Mars, and all I brought back was my ego.
Ooh. Now, very well put, and to offset that, Kat Valenti, who's been on this program a few times, she teaches fantastic things, literally. She teaches about fantasy, and she writes. She's almost done the hat trick this year in the Hugo Awards and Nebula Awards. She's nominated between them in every category a person can be nominated. And besides that, she's a neat lady and a good writer, and she has a short story from this book, Under the Moons of Mars, that she read at a reading I produced about 3 months ago. And it's and we're going to hear that in a moment.
I just want to say goodbye so I can go and listen to it, too.
And you have a show at 5. Oh, yeah. At 5 o'clock. A shadowy kind of a show.
But I guess my ultimate admonition would be that if one has the privilege to travel, to go to strange new worlds and people and concepts, that can be teachers, but only if we listen. There's nowhere on earth or any people or any individual among humanity that does not have something to teach one. And I think the greatest tool of exploration is listening. And I thank you for listening.
And one of the greatest.
And the listeners, too.
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And one of the greatest ways of listening is listening in an expansionist frame of mind, and not imperialist, but expansionist, expanding the mind, thinking about things you wouldn't have otherwise thought of, and taking old things, many imperfect things. And this is what I think Kat did here so beautifully.
Yeah. Well, you have done beautifully in the Pacifica tradition and concept. So I'm going to say goodnight so you can introduce that. And maybe some people will call later on.
Maybe so. But we are now going to listen to John Joseph Adams introducing Kat Valenti, and she is going to read her story from Under the Moons of Mars.
She's generally wonderful and a best-selling author and been nominated for lots of things and won things and whatnot. So, this is still current, though. She lives on an island off the coast of Maine with her partner and two dogs. Is that right? Do you have any more animals that we should update?
I do.
This?
I have six chickens and two huge cats.
Okay, well, she has a lot more animals now. So, Kat Valenti.
So Burroughs, at the beginning of his books, does these little provenance stories where he kind of inserts himself into the narrative and describes where he got this manuscript, which was, you know, written by the actual participants in the story and instead of ERB. And I thought it would be fun to do the same thing. So that's what the first part of this story, which doesn't seem to take place on Mars at all, but rather in Chicago, is all about. Coming of Age on Barsoom. To the reader of this work, in submitting to you the strange soliloquy of Falm Rajut, Jeddak of Hanar Su, I feel it necessary to add a few remarks. This manuscript came into my possession through several twists and turns of coincidence. I had struck up a correspondence with a librarian in Chicago due to our mutual interest in archival issues relating to the early pulp authors. In the basement of her library, my friend had discovered an astonishing number of books, magazines, periodicals, pamphlets, and other paper materials dating from the infancy of science fiction. One could hardly have stumbled onto a cave full of golden cups and sapphire crowns and come away with more awe and delight than that librarian felt, walking up the metal staircase and out of that dusty industrial cellar. Obviously, the new collection belonged to the library proper, but some of the documents proved to be of little value even to the most dedicated soul, being either undecipherable or in such a pitiable state that even scanning into the digital collection might be the death of the poor things. Among the latter were several manuscripts that we both suspected belonged to Edgar Rice Burroughs, whose margins contained some scribbles in his handwriting that bore one of his pseudonyms. Among those lay one particular collection of pages. I couldn't in fairness call it a book. My friend informed me of it, that it was mixed in with a number of ERB's papers, that it was not in English or any dialect she recognized, and that it was short but not in too bad a state of rot. Would I like to come to Chicago and see what I could make of it? My librarian friend was aware that I made a great study of ancient languages when I was younger, and if my vocabularies are not what they once were, I can still fake my conjugations with the best of them. I put aside the novel I had been working on and went west, meeting my friend in person and having a wonderful dinner downtown before happily ensconcing myself in one of the private study rooms of the library. Unfortunately, the document was far beyond the abilities of a lapsed classicist. I actually laughed when I saw it, 5 pages inked on both sides, covered in hieroglyphics and ideograms I could not begin to guess at. I could not even say what language they might be or what region of the world might have influenced the rounded, complex characters. I handled the pages carefully, examined them as best I could, but honestly, I am only human, and I hadn't even finished my doctorate. As is my habit, I posted a description of my Chicago adventure to my blog and thought little more of it. ERB is not my favorite of science fiction's grandfathers after all. Yet I found I could not forget the graceful, bulbous hieroglyphs. They floated in my dreams, huge and green like living things, promising illumination to a more determined scholar. Having always been prone to insomnia, I found I could scarcely sleep for a moment without those phantasms appearing behind my closed eyes and waking me with a start, and soon I simply ceased to sleep at all. In the midst of this misery, an email arrived in my inbox bearing the subject heading, Emergency Translation Services Available Day and Night. Even if it were spam, I was curious and possibly desperate, certainly exhausted, enough to open the message. I reproduce it here verbatim. Having read of your linguistic troubles, we wish to offer a cipher which we believe will offer some succor. Please do not ask us where we discovered such a valuable piece of information. We could not possibly share our sources. Really, it is beyond our morality to betray such confidences. Well, perhaps your insistence has swayed us. While traveling in Arizona, we chanced upon an old woman whose costume was decorated with bones and skulls in a quite unsettling way, selling charms and trinkets, bits of silver and turquoise, such as are common in the Southwest. Our sister enjoys silver, and we purchased several bangles, a large red stone pendant, and two rings. Much later, our sister informed us that the pendant proved to be a kind of locket, and within a carefully folded piece of parchment, bore strange marks and a kind of code. Upon examination, we, of course, immediately recognized the handwriting of Edgar Rice Burroughs, may he rest in peace in all sovereignty, and felt certain the paper was a Rosetta Stone for the purpose of translating Tharkian into English and vice versa. We are happy to offer these services to you free of charge as a fellow traveler and believer. Signed. At the time, I could not say what belief I was meant to have in common with my strange and earnest translators, but I accepted their offer, and cipher in hand, I made the following translation of the incomplete, as I came to understand, document, a scanned copy of which my librarian friend was kind enough to send me. I possess no originals of the following, and as to my linguistic benefactors, I have only guesses and wild speculation, as I have heard nothing further from them, even after the publication of Falm Rajout's strange words. Yours very sincerely, Catherine M. Valenti. A Child of Thark, by Falm Rajout, Jeddak Apanarsu, translated by Catherine M. Valenti. Inside the egg, I could taste the sun. It was dry and dusty and soft like sweet ash. I sucked on the sun, and the sun was a yolk, and it passed into me and out of me, and the world was my egg, and I was my egg, and I was the world. I was somewhat aware of other eggs, other worlds, rustling around me, their occasional dreamy movements filling the world that was me and the yolk and the sun and the egg with a gentle kind of music. I was content in the egg, and from the sunny, ashy yolk, I drew both the strength of my six limbs and the greening shade of my skin, but also a sure knowledge of my heart, and a purpose that tasted thick like blood and thick like fat and thick like the weight of a mate held with a second pair of arms. John Carter could never understand us. He never slept in the egg. When the egg cracks, it hurts. Somewhere in the bones, the vibration is so awful and loud you think you will snap, that there was no strength after all, that you are not ready. Oh, you are not ready. Being born is like dying, and no one wants to die. When I think back on it now, I imagine that the egg was my first opponent, that it too wanted to live, and so did I, and only one of us could go on. I was Jeddak of the egg before I was Jeddak of Hanarsu, and the light of my victory blinded me, the light of the sun glancing off the shards of the defeated egg like last weeping cries. Ropey remnants of yolk clung to my tusks, and I tasted them, the last golden, aching sweetness of my life, for nothing in this world tastes quite of that ashen, delicate purpose rushing through every limb. I blinked in the new light. All around me, my brothers and sisters stretched their green bodies for the joy of it, the first expression of might and power and gods. We were so strong. We were so beautiful. Before us stood a long line of enormous, gorgeous gods, our mothers and fathers, their arms outstretched to us. And to remember this pains my chest, my whole life spooling out into a line, and my people standing guard, standing sentinel on that line, willing me to survive and live and thrive, and all of them loving me equally, caring nothing for who laid my egg, only that I was theirs, profoundly and completely. I was their family and their future. All of us were. And we ran to them, to our lives, on legs muscled already and twitching to move, just to move, over that red moss into those green arms. the human John Carter who came to Barsoom like a storm cloud passing back and forth over the sun, over our strength and our purpose, witnessed the generation after mine performing that first radiant dance. He was horrified. He said we had no good qualities because we could not know who our parents were, because our families did not look like his, because it seemed to him nothing but random chance who caught up which child in their arms. I am an old man now. I have forgiven him in the end. He could not help it. What did he look like to us, a bald, white ape, with his terrifying leaps, ready and able and happy to kill us all? And to him we looked like monsters. But I have learned to write in the old way, so you may understand me. It seems to me that writing in this fashion is very slow and an inefficient way to accomplish what the green men do with a glance and a thought. That glimmering net of shared experience and memory that is our collective heart space. I write, and you read, and it is almost as though we stand on a broad red plain together while the moon set and the thoats warble at the stars. That gauntlet is not merely a tangle of green arms. It is a mesh of thoughts and passions snapping like ropes of light cut in half, waiting for one of us to catch the frayed end and connect, to knot ourselves together. They call to us, the mothers and fathers. They say, be my child, be my future. Battle me with your laughter and pinching and sneaking out to hunt the banth when you are not nearly ready. Fight me with your every breath, your every kiss, while I struggle to make you groan and you struggle to die as quickly as possible. And then when I am grown, take my medal and my name and go on while I recede. I admit it looks careless, as though children do not matter to us, much more than a sleeping fur. But the human John Carter could not truly enter the heart space. He was certain he could, that he could read our thoughts with perfect correctness. But you cannot be part of a herd and yet stand outside it. We could not read his thoughts, and so in the shimmering crosshatch of our communal dreaming, he was a terrible blank space, a void, and in his eavesdropping he only ever heard a garbled fraction of what passed between the green men. Yet what he heard miserably diminished. He repeated as though total truth. And in the end, this was what drove me from Tharp to find my own community, a place where the Earthman had not yet told us what we were with his tiny nose in the air. I asked him once what he had been doing just before he came to Barsoom. He answered that he had killed a great number of Indians, which were like the red men, but of Earth. Why? I asked him. What had they done to you? Did you take their places in their tribe, their medal and their name, their wives and their retinue, their responsibility to guide their people and help them survive the winter? You must be a great Jeddak of these Apache if you killed so many. No, he said, the rules of battle are different on Earth. I simply left them and came here. As to what they'd done to me, they were my enemy and had killed my friend. Was not your friend their enemy if you were theirs? Was not killing him their duty? And John Carter did not answer me, but went about his business with his wicked war princess. But I was baffled. He called us barbaric, and yet he left those people without their warriors, and took up no position among them, did not replace their strength with strength, their valor with valor. What kind of man was he? What would he do to us if we became his enemy? I remember the day his war princess Deja Thoris spoke to us with her honeyed words, coaxing us to join her people in amity and fellowship, to unite Barsoom and be clasped to her bosom. I was but young, and yet I recall the black boom of hate and anger that sizzled through the heart space, and how when Tars Tarkas stood to join her, we felt such betrayal. The red men killed our children. In war, they sought out the incubators and smashed the eggs. They wiped out whole communities, reducing the green men inexorably toward extinction. Never once had a red man deigned to take the place of one he killed. They only moved on to destroy more babies and mock us as animals. No wonder the human John Carter found such brotherhood with them. Why should we have joined with her? Because she was beautiful. Because she had a sweet voice. I could not mate with her. I found her upsetting and confusing to look upon, worse to listen to. While reclining on our silks and furs, she claimed we had no art or industry. I kept staring at the silk she lay on. Where did she think it came from? That my mother spun it out of her posterior? She was cruel, and she would not even try to learn to speak our language, to enter the heart space, for that is to become vulnerable. to become raw, to join with us in something deeper and more terrifying than fellowship or amity which may be broken. Even when we battle for supremacy, and why should we not? Barsoom is dying, and every drop of water or scrap of food is a battle we know we will one day lose. Only the very strongest can push us 1 year further, one measly decade or century on through this hard world. How we would like to love the weak as well as the strong. How we would like to mate whenever we wished or give preference to our own blood and work for its supremacy. We cannot afford to. We rein in our instincts so that the green men should live, not merely one green man. Such a thing is the luxury of men like the Earthman John Carter and his impossibly rich and hospitable world. I cannot imagine a place where only one species rules all. What ease he must have had. Why did he ever land upon us with both his feet? I do not like him, I said to my mother, Sukuva. He humiliated Tarstarkus. He made him say he learned friendship from that skinny Earthman. The heart space is bigger than what he calls friendship and has more teeth, too. Why does he think he is better than us? Without us, he would have starved to death. Hush, my little spearhead, my mother said. When you are grown, you may fight him if you dislike him. Bide your time. I have felt sorry for Tarstarkus and his child Sola in my time. I imagine their gentle and loving feelings are a comfort to them, for they could not engage fully with the heart space. Something was broken in them, and we could see them in the crosshatch only as shadows, vague and hazy. They expressed in the outside world the precious love and adoration and communal feeling that we keep inside, for it would surely be used against us by the other folk of Barsoom, who think so little of us, who break our eggs and dance in the ruined yoke. Poor Sarkoja tried to keep Tarstarkus and his woman from passing on their unfit blood to a child, but she could not. She was not vigilant enough. I felt sorry for him then, when he piled up the human John Carter with praise, and we burned with anger, for he preened with his war princess and was made sure of his superiority. We lost face and could not get it back. We would be ruled by a crippled Tharkian, and even a decadent tyrant was better than one who could not see the world inside us except through a dark glass. And so I grew to adulthood. I made myself strong so that one day I could kill the Earthman John Carter and take his medal. I wanted things to be as they were before he came. I wanted to dream in the heart space and hunt game and ride the thoats without having to call them good and pretty for a half hour before I could feed myself, for I was always starving. There is never enough on Barsoom. You are never full unless you are the Earthman John Carter, unless you are a red man licking the yolk off your fingers. My anger sustained me. It filled out my muscles where meat and bone could not. How dare he? How dare he drive off Sarkoja when she did little more than pinch and bite a woman who felt no sorrow while her people destroyed us? How dare he kill our chieftains and take position among us? He had no respect, as he had none for the Apaches he spoke of. I roamed the high hills and wrestled both the great white ape and the banth and bested them both, for I was becoming great in the fullness of my youth, and I feared nothing except the reedy voice of the Earthman John Carter telling us once more that we were brutes and should follow his lead. I walked alone. I took myself from the heart space, and it grieved me like a blow to the skull, but it was worth it. It was enough to end the Earthman John Carter and bring my people home once more. And yet the very day when I resolved that I had achieved my true self, and all my green limbs were hard and hot, when I was ready, oh, I was ready. I went down into Thark with a blaze in my eyes and a blaze in my heart space, as Falmrajut returned to the glittering cross-hatching of thought lines, like an inrushing of air and flame. The young ones shrank back from the brightness of Falmrajut, but Sola herself told me with a haughty smile that the Earthman John Carter had gone back into the heavens and was beyond my reach. Sola could not see the blue fire in my heart's face. How I hated her, collaborator and traitor who gave succor to murderers and would go unpunished. Though John Carter had gone, he would never truly be gone. He had put his foot down upon Barsoom, and everything around that footprint had begun to die. I could not stay in Thark, which was the center of his rot. I could not look Sola in the eye, and each day while she preened and smirked and giggled with Tarstarkus about their friend and how glorious would be the day when he returned. I was a child of Thark. I wanted only to live and hunt and mate and see my people thrive. Instead, I could not even take the medal of the interloper, could not even try. Much later, my rage quieted to a banked ember, floating like a red planet in the heart space. I challenged the old Jeddak of Hanarsu far over the plains, and she was grateful to lay down the burden of her long life under my blade. I watched my wife lay her eggs. I guarded them from the red men and owned several thoats and callots who did their work well. I heard that the Earthman John Carter returned some 10 years hence, but by that time I had a community to think of, and I led them deep into the mountains to be safe from him, from his pride, from his ignorance. But then, that lonely day when I was so ready to destroy him, when I was so strong, when the sun spilled over my green skin like yolk, I only turned my head to the sky where somewhere I knew he hid from me. And I laughed, a long, terrible, awful laugh. Our laughter was never mirth. It is our greatest grief and mourning, our agony and regret for how things must be on this difficult, painful world, our wishing fate could have gone another way, our crying out for the cruelty and unfair asymmetry of the life that owns us. It was always our weeping.
Catherine M. Valenti, reading at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings on March 6th of this year, but 3 days before the 100th anniversary of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Princess of Mars and the publication date itself of the book Under the Moons of Mars, inspired by the work of Edgar Rice Burroughs, but New Adventures on Barsoom, edited by John Joseph Adams. And I think what Kat does there is just a spectacular version of what we were talking about earlier, the ability to look at the other in a way. And here is the voice of the other telling us about what Robert was describing a little bit earlier, that uber European, perfect American type, that if not bringing just superior mentality and all that, at the very least is, you know, superior, well, firepower or muscle power or whatever it may be, in an imperialistic manner. But here, take a modern view inspired by those stories and see, and this is part of the point I was making to Robert when this whole discussion that created tonight's show began with, is the idea, my premise, my belief that sullied though some of these older materials may be, there is still something to glory within them, even if you have, say, political issues with the movie John Carter. And I have to say that they ultimately should be more political than anything else, because despite all the screaming and yelling and all that, the movie's failure in my mind is, and failure, alleged a failure at the box office, had more to do with marketing than with the movie itself. I thought the movie was, in some ways, really a solid, well-done, you know, 3 out of 4 star movie. And I was amazed when everybody was dumping on everybody being critics and stuff like that. But when I went to the people that read the stuff, that are the science fiction fans and the adventure movie fans and the Comic-Con fans and all that, I didn't hear anybody say anything against it, except some true diehard Edgar Rice Burroughs fans who didn't care for some of the updatings here and there and that kind of a thing. I thought it was overall a very successful film in a number of ways, especially when you compare it to certain other ones. So, there. Now you got a sample, a nice taste, a nice flavor of one. Well, you got the full story of one of the stories in this anthology, Under the Moons of Mars. And through Simon & Schuster and John Joseph Adams, who edited the book, we have a number of copies available at to give to you in exchange for a donation of $35. Funny thing, when Robert left here about 10, 15 minutes ago, we had a tally of $25. And now, amazingly, we have a tally of $200, including, by the way, $50 tally, $50 pledge from Virginia. So much so for talking about this gentleman of Virginia. But hey, it's a friend of mine and somebody who I know from, 30 years ago, his volunteering at BAI, who in fact I'm going to see next week, because next week I am going to Washington, D.C. to partake in the Nebula Awards ceremony, where I'm going to be conducting, it would appear to be, nonstop interviews with nominees, other members of Science Fiction Writers of America, and the Grandmaster, Connie Willis. So it's going to be a ton of fun. And how I'm going to work out 40 interviews in the space of 4 days, you know, and try to get full shows out of it, well, that will be interesting. And I will be back here, by the way, the last Wednesday of the fundraising drive, the last Wednesday of the month, with Edward Einhorn, who is the author and director of new off-Broadway production of The Lathe of Heaven, based on the novel by Ursula K. Le Guin. And if it's anything like what Edward did with Philip K. Dick's novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, this is somebody who really understands science fiction and the theater and how to merge them. And I hope that you tune in for that program. And oh yes, be prepared that time also to get into the wallet for some very, very, very cool premiums. But so far, as I was mentioning, we have this premium, This Morning, Under the Moons of Mars. I'm not going to hard sell it now because we only have a few minutes left and maybe we'll take some phone calls on the air. But why don't you pledge? Why don't you avail yourself of a copy of this book? A $35 pledge to WBAI will get you a copy of Under the Moons of Mars, edited by John Joseph Adams, with such writers in it. I gave a list before: Joe Lansdale, David Barr Kirtley, Peter S. Beagle, Toby Bacall, Dora Goss, Ellie Modessa Jr., Genevieve Valentine, Chris Claremont, you just heard Catherine M. Valenti and Jonathan Mayberry. Yes, and an appendix by Richard A. Lupoff, Dick Lupoff, who, by the way, has done a certain amount of science fiction radio over the years for Pacifica out at KPFA, our original station in Pacifica, California. If you would like to discuss what you have heard this morning, you can call in on the air at 212-209-2900. If you would like to pledge, an even better idea, you can do that at 212-209-2950. So it's 00 to talk on the air and 50 in order to pledge money. Maybe you'll even manage to do both. That would be way cool. A lot of cool things coming up on this program after we get out of fundraising drive mode, including the aforementioned Chris Claremont will be here. And I just recorded an interview with John Shirley, one of the founders of Cyberpunk. He also did a reading for us. Oh, and our next reading, yes, May 22nd, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will feature Brian Francis Slattery and Charlie Jane Anders, editor of IO9 and columnist. And both will be reading both fiction and nonfiction. Our curator for that evening will be Liz Gorinsky. For more information, visit my website, ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F www.thewhitenation.com. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
That was as thought-provoking a story as I have heard in a long, long time.
Yeah, until you hear the next Kat Valenti story, because all of her stories are thought-provocative.
Well, I've always said about... I said to her once that she produced the most complex frame story I've ever come across.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's interesting that you were talking about the era when Burroughs was writing. He wrote westerns as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he... Actually, some of them surprise me. I was once on a panel at a WWA convention, and we were talking about the precursors, the early 20th century, and some of them actually really stand up better than most, although I would point something out that in the 1920s, you know, Zane Grey published a story in which there was a romance between... By the way, I always have used the term First Nations folk. I know that the arguments about Native Americans, American Indians, I loved your word, autochthonous. I love that word.
Autochthonous, yes.
Yes, it's a great word. I've always used with the Canadians, who are very sensible about this. First Nations, they were there first.
So far as we know. Yeah, I say autochthonous because we know they're from here.
Yeah, that's
first
right.
Nations assumes we know it all.
Well, we should know that's true. Oh, as an academic, I realize after 40 years I knew less than I did when I started. Anyway,
I was so much older then. I'm younger then than now.
Wasn't that a song? Yes.
Should be.
The whole era of the period from the 1870s and 80s to even World War II was rife with writers. And I think of P.C. Wren, who wrote the Beaugest books. And, of course, when you think about it, you know, they were, to me, they were equal opportunity mischief makers. You know, it wasn't only Africans who got the... negative end of the shaft. It was Arabs, Mexicans, Polynesians. I mean, everybody. You know, everybody got it. And you know, I thought about the Kat Valenti story in a different sense. Are you familiar with the
We don't have a lot of time.
The
by
term
the way,
cargo cult. You familiar with the cargo cults?
It's a term I have heard, but I don't know a lot about it.
Well, they were basic very quickly. They were when the flyers, Japanese and Americans, brought the airplanes and they brought goodies to the people of New Guinea. Whole religion grew up about it. But this would be as if somebody from New Guinea wrote a story about the not so good aspects of it,
mm-hmm.
which is why I think that Kat Valenti really, really came up with the other side.
Oh, yeah, she did that beautifully. That's why, I mean, I had a few stories to choose from, and I could have read one.
I don't think you could have picked, let me put it.
But this one was totally appropriate.
And it was short and pithy.
Yes.
And it said what it had to say. And it's the kind of thing that makes you think. And if you can, and it engenders more questions than it answers, which to me is... And you and Robert had a beautiful discussion. You were like the rabbinical Talmudic masters. You know, you engendered more questions than answers.
Yeah, well, hopefully. I mean, I'm very pleased that we got to do about an hour of it, but I am also annoyed that we didn't get to do more of it because of the difficulty in the beginning of the pledge drive. But next time out, maybe we'll just do it as a show.
Well, there's two questions that you should bring up in the next time, and that would be very quickly. How the world has opened up in terms of what writers and speculative, especially fantasy literature, are doing with non-American, non-European cultures, as opposed to what was happening 20 years ago or 30 years ago, when, as Paul Anderson said in Sudden Blunder, except for a few cases, it was mostly Anglo-Celtic, Northern European, etc.
Mm-hmm.
The other question is, are the fantastic literatures of Asia and Africa and the Pacific and non-Europe, Latin America, being readily available to the Americans? And I told you last week that there are some excellent translations. And I hope you'll do a show like that, because I'd love to share that with you.
Well, sometime perhaps when I have Michael Kandel on, we can discuss that, because...
Who is he?
He's with the MLA. The Modern Language Association.
Well,
and, and he's a major translator and purveyor of translators.
And he's translated foreign texts into English?
Polish, mostly.
Oh, Polish. Well,
with a specialty in Stanislaw Lem. He's been on several times.
Okay. Well,
it's been a while since he's been on, though. I'd love to have him back.
Anyway, have fun in Washington.
Okay, thanks. Take care. And, it is almost 2:44, and something else is going to be coming on these airwaves at 3 o'clock, and I have no idea what. It is not Lister with Burn Baby Burn Clappers. He is preempted this morning for the thon, but I have little doubt that... Tony will be in here with some recorded work. As far as I know, I'm pretty sure I'm not on, I can't be on next week because I'll be winging my way or elbowing my way to Washington by that time for the Nebula Awards. And the week after that, I believe I am preempted, but I will be returning to these airwaves, as mentioned, approximately, I think it's the 30th of the month, May 30th. And let me just see here. Will this yield a calendar for me? Nope, of course not. I've got another device here. So the Nebula Awards and the Hugo Awards this year are particularly interesting. They, especially the Nebulas, have opened up the way that they do their voting so that there's a whole new batch of nominees who are available, and that's made it rather exciting. It is actually, Wednesday the 30th, Thursday, May 31st, for where my guest will be Edward Einhorn, and we are going to be discussing his production of The Lathe of Heaven, and that will include an interview with Ursula K. Le Guin. If his interview isn't available by then, we're not sure about that, then my interview with Ursula will be a portion of the show. And again, May 22nd, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will be presenting Brian Francis Slattery and Charlie Jane Anders. Look them up, or better yet, join my mailing list. Actually, the mailing for this isn't going out till like tomorrow or Friday. I've got most of the literature together, but I have to get it approved and all that, and then I'll be putting it in various media. Oh, yes, there is, by the way, a Facebook group, an Hour of the Wolf Facebook group. If you're on Facebook, you just go there and look for Hour of the Wolf. And for that matter, there's also a Facebook group for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which is that series that I was talking about. And I hope that you will, join both groups. Why not? That way you'll be on top of it all. In the meantime, I am gone for a while, for a couple of weeks, and we'll be back at the end of May and ongoing after that. Thank you for listening. Thank you, those who pledged and those who will pledge and who have pledged in the past. And enjoy yourselves. Have a wonderful week. And take care. We'll be talking with you soon. Good morning.
And the UFO's love will wing for me when I'm gone.
This is Rick Wolf, host of Economic Update. On Friday, May 18th at 7 p.m., join the Brecht Forum as we present The Beginning is Near, a conversation with Cornel West and Michael Moore. This historic evening will bring together two of the most forward thinkers of the left movement for an evening of humor, depth analysis, and celebration of global movements against the 1%. This conversation will take place Friday, May 18th, at Hunter College Assembly, 68th Street between Lexington and Park. For more information, contact 212-242-4201. That's 212-242-4201, or check us out at brechtforum.org.
My name is Dan Ingram, and I'm a WBAI fan. They've always been, you know, the station that kicked butt and the station that said what you're not supposed to say because the people in power don't want to hear it. And I love that.
I have to celebrate you, baby.
Warlords. Sweet in the morning.
Sweet in the morning. Indeed. Good morning. It's Wednesday, May 9th. How are you? I hope you're good this morning. We continue week two of Fun Drive. And we're continuing our theme on Wake Up Call Way Up, where we're bringing you hosts from other shows, producers from other shows. And who are joining us for our hot topics first thing in the morning before we get into pitching. And so this morning, we of course have Ife Danzi, our engineer, with us. Good morning, Ife.
Good morning. I'm quite tired.
Quite tired. She's just been on air. You just did your show with G-Man, right?
Mm. Yes. I've been here since 1:30.
Since 1:30. This is how we do WBAI. This is what we call stellar shifts. This is pre-1970 working conditions. We're also joined live in studio by Rebecca Miles. Now, you're normally hearing Rebecca's voice on the news from Sunday to Monday.
Friday.
Sunday to Friday. 6 p.m. every night on this, on the 99.5. But this morning, Rebecca, under duress, under Guantanamo conditions, has actually come to studio with us. Hi, Rebecca.
Good morning.
Wearing your wonderful lime green T-shirt. That's to keep her awake. It's so great how everybody's coming in and feeling the pain that we have. Wake Up Call. To be up and energized this early in the morning, but we appreciate you coming through. So it is all about the economy, what's happening here in New York, what is happening nationally. Coming up, economic justice, your work, your money, your homes, your history, your choice, your chance, your knowledge, your power, people focus. We are occupying the economy and challenging capitalism with world-renowned economist Dr. Richard Wolff in conversation with David Barsamian. It's a brand new book, plus a brand new exclusive presentation. It literally only happened last night right here in New York City, but we have that presentation, that talk for you in our special Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism pack by world-renowned economist Dr. Richard Wolff. All of that coming up. This is Wake Up Call Week 2. Fun Drive continues. Sounds of ABBA there, because that's what it's all about, the economy and money. Well, 2007 was when the economy crashed, but go back
before that, before the 1970s, America's productivity steadily grew every single year, and so did the living wage for workers. It was actually a unique space in the world. It created a nation of productivity, and it meant that Americans could send their kids to college. Their living wage was increasing according to their productivity. That happened right up until the 1970s, according to Dr. Richard Wolff in his brand new book, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, with David Barsamian. And we have that for you, plus an exclusive presentation that happened last night right here in New York, as I said in the introduction. But then things changed post-1970 in a massive, massive way. Wages essentially stopped growing. You stopped making more money despite doing the same work and then doing more work and then more work and then more work and then longer hours and then taking second jobs and having to consistently up the ante of your productivity whilst not earning more money. Well, Dr. Wolff is a professor of economics, emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He's also a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs of the New School University right here in the Apple. Dr. Wolff has also taught economics at Yale University, City here in New York, at the University of Paris in Sorbonne, and the Brecht Forum right here, of course, in New York. In 2010, Dr. Wolff published Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. But this morning it is all about occupying the economy and challenging capitalism. So we're going to hear a bit from this exclusive presentation. This happened just last night, literally. Thank you to Dred Scott Keys, who literally went down and then bogarted it down into the station to make sure we had this for you this morning. So this is just a taste of what we'll be offering as part of our premium. Dr. Wolff will join us live at 7 a.m. We're in the Hot Topics part of the show, where we're talking about the economy, cuts, education, jobs, what is going on, and why unemployment is in the mess that it is in. We're going to start by hearing from Dr. Richard Wolff.
The first one has to do with arguably the single most important number, if you're going to pick one, about our economy that is available, and that is unemployment. Unemployment in the United States is a fine index of where things stand. Doesn't answer every question, but it's a good place to start. And let's go over. When this crisis began officially, December of 2007, the official start, the unemployment in the United States, simply counting those people, I'm going to go over that with you, who are looking for work and unable to find it and say so to the government. You're going to see later why that's important. That number was 5%. 5%. So the crisis hits at a time of 5% unemployment. Over the year 2008, 2009, unemployment shoots up and eventually gets to 10%. It effectively doubles. Over the last year and a half, unemployment has come down to a little over 8%. But to describe 8%, that's what we have now, a little more than 8%, as a recovery is a use of language that is extreme. We haven't recovered. We haven't gotten halfway back to where we were before this crisis hit. That would be 7.5%, and we have 8%+. So there is no recovery, if by that you normally mean we have come back from where we were. We have not done that, and we're not close. And there is no prospect that that's going to happen anytime soon, where anytime soon means at least several years. So that's the first. Second, the Obama administration made a political decision late last year to work hard to bring the unemployment down a little bit, and then to hype that phenomena as a recovery. That was a dangerous decision to make, because it linked the president's claim to be an effective leader during a time of economic crisis to a number that might not bear that out. And that's where he stands now. The unemployment, which was shrinking, has stopped shrinking. Over the last 2 or 3 months, it basically hasn't changed at all. The latest numbers for the month of April are actually so bad that the number of new jobs created in April was less than the number of people entering the labor market, young people, for the first time, which means not only that unemployment will not go down, it will go up. When you begin to look, as economists do, at the numbers in some detail, things get grimmer. First, I have to explain, I know some of you know this, but bear with me, how unemployment is calculated in the United States. It also varies from country to country, and it's actually varied here in the United States. It hasn't always been done the way I'm going to describe it's done now. Basically, the government makes a survey. It asks people the first question. There's two questions. First question, are you working? If your answer is, yes, I'm working full time, then you're considered employed. If you answer no, you are asked the second question. Are you looking for work now? If you answer yes, that is, you don't have a job and you are looking, then you're counted as an unemployed person. If you answer that second question, no, I'm not looking, you're not counted at all. So unemployment doesn't count all the people who have no job, doesn't count the people who have no job, have been looking for several months, and simply said, to hell with it, I'm not looking anymore. Those people are considered to no longer be in the labor force. They're neither employed nor unemployed. Now, without doing the advanced mathematics, let me tell you what that means in terms of arithmetic. If from 1 month to the next, 100,000 of the unemployed people stop looking for work, they drop out of the labor force, and unemployment goes down arithmetically, even though not a single one of those people got a job. And the government will announce, often with great fanfare, how pleased we are that unemployment went down from 8.3% to 8.1%. Isn't that wonderful? What they're describing is the phenomena of hundreds of thousands of unemployed people no longer looking for work. That will have that effect on the arithmetic. So it is very bizarre. Keep that in mind when you hear it. There has been such a turmoil about this that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, a major source of information about all of this, actually keeps a whole bunch of unemployment statistics. And the one that I think myself and many others do too, and not left-wingers or right-wingers, there's lots of people who do this work, is what they call U-6. U for unemployment, number six out of a whole bunch of measurements. U-6 measures three groups of people. One, those looking for work and not finding it, the people I just referred to, the 8.whatever it is percent, plus what are called discouraged workers, or the other term that's becoming more popular, workers marginally connected to the labor force. The words give away a lot. That's what the statisticians call it. So the second group are the people who've quit looking. And the third group are the people who have a part-time job